It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Wow, we got a great panel for you. Christina Warren's going to bring her Snapchat spectacles. Devendra Hardawar, his great good humor. And Ed Bott, his acerbic assessment of the tech scene. We'll talk about all sorts of stuff, including, is Russia hacking the United States? And what can we do about it? Next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 592, recorded Sunday, December 11th, 2016. McAfee for Cyber. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/twit and entering the promo code TWIT. And by Carbonite. Keep your business safe this year. Protect files on your computer or server with automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Try it free. No credit card needed at carbonite.com today. Use the offer code TWIT to get 2 free bonus months if you decide to buy. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/twit and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/twit. And by Harry's, for guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, just in time for the holidays, get $5 off a holiday shave set by going to harrys.com and using the offer code TWIT5. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, show where we talk about the week's tech news with a panel, hand-assembled, carefully crafted panel of tech journalists. Three of the best with me today via Skype. From New Mexico, Ed Bott of ZDNet joins us. Great to see you, Ed.
It is a pleasure to be here, Leo.
And I see over your right shoulder, your left shoulder, my right, the Bob Dylan poster to celebrate his Nobel-tude. Nice.
Yeah, you gotta give him props for that speech that he wrote this week. It was amazing.
Wrote but didn't read. I think the ambassador to Sweden ended up reading it, and Patti Smith performed, but he did not go to the. He has to give a lecture if he wants the $800,000. So here's my question. How much, so clearly Bob Dylan's too cool for school and it's not going to go, right? That's why he didn't go. But here's the question. $800,000. Do you give the lecture?
I think if you go to Google and type in Bob Dylan net worth, you realize
he doesn't need to.
You know, $800,000 is, it would be nice, but he doesn't need it.
I love it. Also with us from Gizmodo, she's a senior editor there. It's great to have film girl Christina Warren.
Hey, great to be here.
Nice to see you with your Apple TV in the background.
Yes. Apologies for the lighting in this room. This is the best I could do. It's gotten dark a lot earlier.
I know. Well, in a way it's better because what it used to be is you'd start all lit and then the sun would come
right,
out. And then we get pitch black. So this is good. You're prepared. Devendra Hardawar is also here joining us. I think you're in New York, right, from Engadget, Brooklyn?
I'm in New York, yeah.
Yeah, Engadget.com. Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Brooklyn.
I understand there's a
can't
difference.
Can't afford Manhattan. Yeah, big difference.
Who can?
You're
can
in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn now.
You're in
anyway.
Brooklyn it's too, all, right, Christina?
I am in Brooklyn, yeah. Yes.
It's all crazy now. Yeah.
It was a great YouTube video. Settlers of Brooklyn. Did you see that?
Yes, I think so.
It's, there's the great game Settlers of Catan, mm-hmm. and a lot of people play it. Well, this is a bunch of hipsters, not Hitlers.
Wow.
Bunch of hipsters sitting around playing the award-winning game of entitlement, self-discovery, and hipstertude. Oh, man. Somebody put a lot of effort into this. Which pizza parlor do you frequent, Devendra?
I have a couple I really like.
I understand that's one way to distinguish mm-hmm. Brooklynites.
There are. In my neighborhood right below me, there is one called DeFara's, which has been around. It's like an 80-year-old guy who's been doing it for forever. Oh. And he's just there hand rolling the pizza every day.
Perfect. You're not so some amazing. Johnny come lately. You are the real deal.
That's the place where, like, he won't even let his son roll the dough, right? Like, his son can help assemble, but he's still not allowed to, like, roll. But yeah, he's still the one.
It's the Jiro Dreams of Sushi of pizza.
Like, oh, really?
The basil comes from, like, Israel or something. It's all fresh. It's all, like, special ingredients. And you go there and you wait maybe an hour or two for a pizza.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I've got to come out and go. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's. Where should we kick off this show today? Was there a big story this week? I think the funniest story is Samsung saying in a few days, on December 19th, they're going to send an update to Note 7s that will basically turn them into bricks. You won't be able to use a Note 7 unless it's plugged in.
Right.
They're effectively rendering it useless. But the funny part is when Verizon said, we're not going to do that upgrade.
First of all,
how many Note 7s are still out there?
They say that 93% have been turned in. So this is in the United States. And so I think that in the U.S. they sold about 2 million. So whatever 93% of 2
it's
million
like
140,000.
That's a lot.
I guess it's not non-trivial. I don't know how many of those are on the Verizon network. I think it's probably a better question.
And I have to say, I haven't seen a lot of reports of Galaxy Notes bursting into flames. So maybe these are the ones that are okay.
I mean, I don't think you can say that. I mean, I think that
clearly Samsung doesn't believe it.
Right. Well, and neither does the Consumer Safety, Product Commission. Right. And neither do any of the other agencies around the world. So, they definitely want everybody to turn them in, and that's why they want to issue this update. I think it's interesting that Verizon won't do it, and they claim that it's because of the holiday season.
Let me read the quote.
So, yeah, sure.
Because that's what they're saying. And I think that's funny because they call it a software upgrade. It's not an upgrade. We will not push, says Verizon, a software upgrade that will eliminate the ability for the Note 7 to work as a mobile device in the heart of the holiday travel season. We do not want to make it impossible to contact family, first responders, or medical professionals in an emergency situation. That's reasonable, although sure. Samsung said we would prefer that people's houses don't burn down during the holiday season, too.
Well, and the Federal Aviation, Administration has said we would prefer, we're actually going to insist that these not be taken on airplanes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So holiday travel season, unless you're on an airplane, in which case every major airline will tell you before you get on board, you're not allowed to have it. And if you do have it, you need to put it in a special, a flammable proof bag that has to be in your line of sight at all times and then dispose of it. So I don't know. John Gruber had kind of an interesting aside on this. He said, why didn't Verizon push for them to do this sooner? I think that's probably fair. They pushed out some similar bricking updates in other countries. I don't think it's okay that Verizon's doing this, to be honest. I think that whatever opinion you have over a company taking this course of action to brick a phone, and I certainly understand the point of view, which is to say, I bought this device, I'm the one who takes the risk. When it does become a safety issue, I understand making the decision to brick the phone. But although I get the broader concerns with what I bought, I didn't really buy. But I don't really like a carrier stepping in and taking the unilateral position of usurping what the company wanted. Because if they're doing it in this case, they're basically Verizon is basically claiming that for their on their network they're more important.
Well, they may not want to get sued by somebody who's having a heart attack and couldn't call 911 because their phone wouldn't work.
Well, but I mean, they've given them many, many opportunities to return the phone.
Stacey Higginbotham's parents still were using Note 7s until like last week. And they finally stopped because they said, you can't make a call. You can't do anything. Every time you do anything on the phone, there's a pop-up saying, please turn this phone in. Please.
Right.
Please,
so
please.
you know, I mean, I think part of it comes down to, has Verizon done a good enough job of getting people in themselves? I mean, I know that in Australia, Samsung New Zealand and Samsung Australia, you know, were issuing, were sending out updates very, very quickly, and we're getting all the carriers on board to constantly send notifications. So part of me wonders, was Verizon not really doing enough to get people to turn their phones in and making it as easy as possible to turn your phone in? I know that early on with the first recall, not the second complete recall, it was a nightmare for customers to even exchange their phone. And so you could understand why people wouldn't want to go through the hassle. But at this point, I mean, it's not just a safety concern. It's a safety concern. So I kind of don't like the idea of a carrier saying in any situation, we're going to unilaterally refuse to allow, you know, we're going to be the gatekeepers to decide what can and can't be issued to your phone. Because if they could do it in this instance, we also see them do this in instances of software updates that need to be issued. You know, like Apple's the only company, and Google through, you know, through the Pixel, but, you know, historically through the Nexus line, who could kind of bypass the carriers. And you see certain phones that are sold, like those, like the blue phones that had malware on them. And carriers, you know, they'll issue out an update, but then the carriers won't let the updates through. And so I don't like a carrier ever stepping in and saying, we're not going to issue an update to this phone for whatever reason. I don't like the precedent that sets.
But this is what Verizon has always done. This has been their modus operandi on every phone. It's one reason why I stopped. Verizon is the only U.S. carrier that I can use, because here in my office, it's the only one where I get a decent signal. And they would not issue updates for the Windows phone that I owned. I mean, 6 or 9 months after Microsoft had released it, they were still refusing to issue a major update that the phone desperately needed. And I finally just threw up my hands. They've done that with Android phones as well.
For no good reason.
For no good reason whatsoever. To go back to something that you said, Leo, I wanted to pile on a little bit there. You know, you said maybe these are the safe phones that are out there. I read an interesting analysis of the problem with the Note 7 the other day. There was a group of material analysts that had done some microphotography of the phone, and they had basically determined that Samsung, in their desire to make a phone that was as thin as possible, had basically not left any expansion room for the battery in the case. And all batteries expand. You know, it's only a micron or two or three, but you have to leave some expansion room. And so what that means, if their analysis was correct, is that this was eventually going to happen to every phone.
And that
the first phones that they discovered this flaw in were the canaries in the coal mine. But there, you know, this was going to happen, you know, more and more often, and probably increasingly, you know, as you hit the 1 year mark, and you know, you really started feeling the heat on these battery packs. So, you know, just a terrible. I just can't imagine that Samsung's brand is going to remain, you know, is not going to suffer major damage from this event.
Does Samsung ever say why?
They haven't figured it out from the last report.
They don't know.
Yeah, there was the whole thing early on where they like spent some time researching it, and yeah, they didn't give
us an
answer. They
never figured it out.
Although I wonder if this is going to be a warning sign to all manufacturers where, you know, maybe we should stop making phones as thin as possible, and maybe we should look at other things. Because when you take that together with something like fast charging, which Samsung has also been pushing thanks to their chips, and I think some Qualcomm chips do that too, you know, that's a lot of power happening very quickly in a really tight environment, and that could be a problem.
The last thing I'm looking at, this is Tech Times from September. Samsung says, at least in the Chinese phones, because remember at first they said, oh, well, you don't have to worry about the phones in China because they use a different battery. And then there were fires. And they said, well, that was from external heating, not the battery heat. But I think it confirms kind of, Ed, your supposition that it's just there's no room for expansion.
Right.
And everything that warms up gets bigger. And not leaving, right?
Yeah, I think that's FUD's third law of opposition.
FUD's third law of opposition. Whatever goes up must explode. Well, anyway, 133,000 to 140,000 people still have Note 7s. December 19th, unless you're on Verizon, in which case you're good. Just keep using it. Why not? Now, you guys, when you flew out from Milwaukee, did they tell you, did they announce no Note 7s? Yeah, they did say it. Because I talked to somebody yesterday, said when we flew out, they didn't say anything. So some airlines have thrown up their hands.
I was on at least a half a dozen flights last week. We did a nice vacation, and there were at least six flights involved. And on every single one, wow, there were extended safety advisories about the Note 7. And, you know, and they didn't say anything about putting it in a bag or anything. What they said is, you know, if you have one, you have to alert the cabin crew, and, you know, you can't turn it on, and it must be, you know, it must be out where we can see it at all times. But every single one had a full speech that they gave on it.
Wow. This has got to be bad for the brand all around. Can't imagine. Now, we're hearing rumors I don't think it's a rumor. I think I'm sure it's true. Samsung will announce the S8 in March at Mobile World Congress. Right, Devendra?
I mean, I assume
that's
so.
That's when they normally do it.
Yeah.
I mean, they've had like several of it. They've had separate events too, right? So that's the thing. Mobile World Congress hasn't been the sort of big phone announcement event for a very long time. But I don't know. Maybe they'll need some of that partner help this year.
And will they ever do another Note?
Can't imagine.
I think they have to kill the Note name. I think it has to be done.
Yep.
I think you have a product that is exactly the same as the Note in every single way, but it has the pin, it has
it's
the SN, it has everything.
Huge
but
success.
You can't call it a Note.
I mean,
sure.
I mean, when they first, the Note, the original Note, everybody laughed at me when I got it. And then by 3 years or 4 years later, everybody had a 5-inch, 6-inch phone. Everybody.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, they also got smaller too, so it wasn't the screen size. The physical form factor got
screens
better.
Got bigger and bigger, but the bezels got short, smaller, and so the phone got smaller. In fact, that was one of the things that was great about the Note 7 is it was smaller than an iPhone 7.
Feels great
with a bigger screen, the 5.7-inch screen, a bigger screen.
Yeah, I noticed that too about the Pixel XL. It just feels really good in your hand, especially compared to like the iPhone 6 Plus or the 7 Plus. Like those things, way too big for me.
Well, I mean, I feel bad for Samsung. I think Samsung's doing everything they can. It's so ironic that Verizon is going, not so fast. And think of the liability if one of these phones, the Verizon phones, does have a fire and cause a problem. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what seems like, interesting about this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're putting themselves
in the line
of fire.
It sounds like this may be partially like a lawyer decision too. Like maybe they did the math and like, we're figuring the circumstances of somebody not having access to their phones versus it is a small chance of a fire, but it's still a chance of a fire. Yeah. So I don't know. I feel like I can't say too much before the Verizon sniper is getting me. So because technically I work for Verizon.
Right.
Wait a minute. That's right.
That's right.
Verizon owns you.
I got to watch out, guys.
It's so confusing. Verizon owns you. Samsung doesn't own Christina. Who owns Christina?
No.
Univision.
And EdBot, one knows who owns ZDNet. It's confusing.
it's CBS Interactive.
Okay.
Which is in turn, that's Sumner Redstone.
Viacom?
So basically it's Sumner Redstone. We can make some Emperor Palpatine jokes here, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't think he's actively involved anymore, is he? He's 93 years old.
Emperor Palpatine.
Well, there was a whole proxy war
he's
over his control.
He's 930 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the family, apparently he's kind of non-compos mentis at this point, and the family's trying to take the money and run. Inside the, here it is, from Vanity Fair, of course, but this is last March or April. Inside the raging legal battle over Sumner Redstone's final days. I think he's still alive.
Yeah, yes.
Yep.
Anyway, I don't know how we got into that.
Media's weird.
Media's weird. I can agree with you on that.
It all started with Verizon. And then, of course, you've got Verizon is currently on the hook to buy Yahoo.
Yeah, what's the story there? We have heard nothing.
I think after the whole big Yahoo hack, Verizon's like, hey, guys, you didn't tell us about this.
So. They said, well, that should take $1 billion off right off the top.
Totally.
Right?
Probably should. Oh, man. Yeah. At our offices here in New York, we have there are a bunch of We Love Yahoo signs around. I wonder if they still love Yahoo. I don't know.
and have we heard anything about Marissa Meyer? I mean, she's still there.
Yeah. Well, she's always said she was going to stay through the transition. And then I think we all assumed that as soon as the sale was complete, that she would obviously leave. Because I don't think there's any way that she would work with Tim Armstrong or work under Tim Armstrong. I just don't see that happening.
Well, and she's got a fairly hefty.
Oh, a very nice golden parachute.
Severance
very nice.
Package.
Very nice.
Yeah. I saw a pic. I'm looking for it. I don't see it. I saw a picture of Marissa at some society event. Looking very content. Not looking at all nervous about anything in the future. All right. I thought I'd start off with something light and chewable. A little aperitif. Before we dig into the somewhat more challenging content, for instance, big tech summit on Wednesday, President-elect Trump is bringing in the big guns. Larry Page, CEO of Alphabet, Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, Facebook COO, Sheryl Sandberg, I know Zuck is not going, will be attending the tech summit. Perhaps even, according to Recode, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, although Bezos, one of the people Mr. Trump doesn't like too much because he owns the Washington Post. Satya Nadella will be there from Microsoft. Chuck Robbins from Cisco. Of course, Jeannie Rometty of IBM. She already has stepped up to volunteer to help in any way with any databases that the president would like to create of any kind. Brian Krzanich of Intel and Safra Katz, who is apparently the CEO of Oracle, although you don't hear a lot about
it. Co-CEO. She's the co-CEO.
Co-CEO, because that other guy probably is.
Mark Hurd.
And that was quite the quote from her today also.
Yeah, it was.
What did he say? Can I find it? Let me see if I can find it.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, we are here to assist in any way possible with any of your database needs. I mean, it was basically the joke that you just made, only for real.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, no, but that's what IBM, Gina Rometty's famous letter to the Trump administration, where IBM is here to help.
Which, given IBM's past database help,
as they have in the past,
World War II. Exactly. Yeah. They have.
We know how to make.
Let's not do this. Yeah. Great.
If you have $100 billion market cap or higher, you should have been invited. Apparently, that's according to Gabe Rivera. That's the that seems to be the thing.
Right.
In common, he tweeted, based on the invitees named here, it appears public U.S. tech companies with a market cap greater than $100 billion were invited.
Well, that makes it easy. Except Brian Chinsky, who from Airbnb was invited. They certainly don't have that market cap. But I think that he's not able to come, according to Kara Swisher, because he'll be out of town. But I think that
it's convenient. I'm going to Palm Springs. I am so sorry.
Same thing with Travis Kalanick. They'll both be out of the country. I don't know what Uber's, valuation is. They're certainly not, since they're not public. But Airbnb certainly isn't anywhere close to $100 billion. But I think because Peter Thiel, Founders Fund, is a big investor in them, that might have been part of it.
Thiel has become, an advisor to the transition team. But, the president calls, you go, right? I mean, that's pretty traditional.
Well, I mean, I think that what some people were saying in Rico's report and Kara Swisher's reporting, and this is true, is that they went for Obama and they went, for past presidents. So even if you disagree,
you go.
And even you go, the president elect asks, you go. And so even though a lot of these CEOs have publicly supported positions and people that are completely opposite Trump, you're invited, you go. And even though, Trump has had, battles and has threatened, boycotts for companies like Apple. Yeah, you, you show up.
If I were Tim Cook, I might be a little nervous that I might be singled out, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially since we know what happened when he had this similar meeting like this with the media, you know, when he met with CNN and the New York Times one was on the record, but the one that was off the record where
all the anchors went. Yeah.
Yeah. And the executives, and he told Jeff Zucker how terrible CNN was and people were biased against me. So you do kind of wonder, like, is he going to, you know, is this mm-hmm. going to be another one of these meetings where it starts out with Trump airing of the grievances, you know? How dare you, Jeff?
It's almost Festivus. So, you know, bring
your aluminum poles, kids.
Bring your aluminum pole, and we will. Although I think it's going to be a one-way airing of grievances, at least for the next 6 weeks.
You know, if I were one of these CEOs, I'd be very curious. I'd love to hear what President-elect Trump has to say. I mean, in many ways, he's pro-business. Certainly, his cabinet is full of generals and businessmen.
I could see people at least wanting to be there to help stop him.
I don't know. Really? Do you think? I mean, what is your opportunity there to stop anything? I mean, I think you're there to hear.
Well, seeing how the actual situation is working behind the scenes, because Trump is so secretive and doesn't really, you know, he hasn't talked to press normally, and there isn't enough of that access.
It does. You know, you can see his reality show roots because he really does seem to be running this like a reality show. You almost expect cameras outside, and then, you know, Tim Cook going, well, I hope he likes me. I don't want to be kicked off the island. And I mean, it just almost feels like that a little bit, like somebody 10 will enter, but only 9 will come out, kind of a thing.
Ouch.
Mm. We'll see. I don't know.
There is, however, a fairly well established dynamic in the way that Trump operates. You know, multiple people have commented on this, which is that his decisions tend to be heavily influenced by the last person that he talked to.
So you want to get his ear. You want to get in.
So you want to be in the room and you want to make sure that if you have a thing that you want to have happen,
get in the room where it happens.
That you say and you say that out loud and you make your case and hope that earworm gets planted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And tackle everybody else after you. So
that's all. The other tech story having to do with the election and the president-elect. By the way, the CIA and the FBI seem to disagree on this, but the CIA has apparently said that it believes Russia was trying to help Donald Trump win the White House. And their evidence for this is that they now are concluded, and the intelligence community seems to mostly agree, that the Russian government hacked both the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee, but only released the emails of the Democratic National Committee. The president has now asked for a full investigation and a report before he leaves office on January 19th. Don't know what to say. I mean, it's clear that there's hacking on both sides. We hack them, they hack us.
Right.
What would it mean if a foreign government attempted to influence American elections, and what do you do about that if they do?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I see a lot of people like smarmily pointing out, oh, the American government's done this forever in other countries and we deserve this.
We certainly have thrown elections in the past. The CIA, in fact, has thrown elections in the past.
But I think you can separate that issue with this one, which is that, oh my God, the country is on fire. And we gotta do something about it.
One former CIA director said, "If you find out this is the case, you have to do a do over."
Right.
I don't think we're getting a do over.
No.
In fact, I don't even know what the. I mean,
we don't know what to do. Like, that's the thing. A lot of people have been asking. So, okay, the CIA says Russia has basically pushed our election, and Trump, what we know, like, he has had close ties to Putin. He spent a lot of time defending Putin. So where do we go from here? We don't have the mechanisms to do anything, really.
No, there's no precedent.
It's disturbing. Yeah.
There's no precedent.
Of the electors, like, refusing to actually, you know, elect him in.
Right before the election, I remember Biden going on the morning shows and saying, if, you know, almost just basically threatening, if you guys mess with our elections, we have tools in place for a commensurate response.
At a time and place of our choosing.
At a time, we won't tell you what we're going to do, but it will match the impact you had on us. that seemed to be kind of almost a hollow threat, but it was clearly a threat. I mean, don't mess with our elections. Hacking is going to, 2017 is going to be a very interesting year for hacking. I mean, I've been saying that for every year, every December for 5 years now.
Did you guys see the Alex Gibney movie Zero Days?
Yes.
The one about the Stuxnet? Yeah. That's a great film. And also, like, it makes a lot of great points that I think he almost predicted that we'd be seeing more and more of this. So who knew it was going to happen so quickly?
It's a safe and easy prediction. He was talking about our hacking, or maybe the Israeli hacking, certainly governmental hacking of the Iranian centrifuges using the Stuxnet virus to attempt to prevent them from creating an atomic bomb, which, by the way, as surgical strikes go, is a good idea. Unfortunately,
exploded all over the internet.
They didn't design it well enough, and we all got it.
It's pretty insane. But the bigger takeaway from that movie for me was the idea that we kind of need to all get together internationally and say there has to be like an international conversation about these cyber tools, because
a Geneva Accord, if you will, of what we can and can't do. Yeah. We live in interesting times. This is former CIA Director Michael Hayden. This is the trailer for Zero Days, which, if you haven't seen, I think it's on Netflix for free. It
becomes a challenge for all of us to maintain accountability
and control of our critical infrastructure system. I highly recommend, although it's a little terrifying, frankly.
It's okay. We need to be scared.
Well, this is what's going on. There's nobody is gainsaying this. This is as far as I know, 100% accurate.
Power
plants,
power grids, and pump gas
transportation.
It is ironic, isn't it, that the agency that we created and has actively overthrown other governments for years is now calling foul on the Russian government. And of course, the Trump team says, no, that didn't happen.
Well, they didn't just deny it. The press release that they issued, the three-sentence press release, each one of those three sentences was, in fact, not true. So it was three sentences, three lies. But more importantly, normally we have institutions in this country. And you may disagree with the work of the institutions, but the intelligence community is composed of professionals. And what Trump and his people are basically saying is that they disagree with all of the output from the intelligence community. And now his people were saying today, well, we're just going to put our own people in. And that, to me, is actually the more frightening thing. It takes a long time to build up both the defensive, especially the defensive capabilities for this kind of thing. And if the new guy comes in here and, upsets the game board, just throws it up in the air, that has the potential for very, very serious consequences.
The press release said, I can read it in its entirety.
Right.
These are the same people that said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction.
That's not true.
Demonstrably false.
Yeah.
The election ended a long time ago in one of the biggest electoral college victories in history.
That's actually two lies in one sentence, because it was only ended 4 weeks ago.
Right.
And it was the 46th most.
Out of 58.
46th largest out of 58 margins, which is sort of the opposite of a landslide.
That's right.
And statement three, which actually you could debate whether this is true or not. It's now time to move on and make America great again.
Well, I think anybody who looks at this, if you see that 17 agencies in the U.S. intelligence community basically agree that there was some kind of activity by the Russian government, even if you disagree on the scope of that and the impact of that, it's not time to move on. It's time to investigate it. And even if you benefited from it, in a normal election after a normal election result, the winning candidate would say, I agree completely with this. We should have a full investigation.
No, I don't think, and I think then, the winner writes the history, right? So I think that this goes away on January 20th.
But they would control the investigation. And so they would go then. They would
I
say,
see.
Of course, we're going to set up an investigation because that's what you do.
Right.
And then you have a rubber stamp of an investigation.
Then you can just, you know, bury it.
And you let it go on and nobody
comes
up.
That's happened.
By saying vehemently, as
right.
Trump has done, this is not true. How does he know that?
Right.
How does he know this is not true? When, you know, thousands of analysts, you know, have been working on this.
Well,
with
and we should point out, it isn't unanimous. A senior U.S. official said there were minor, this is according to the Post, there were minor disagreements among intelligence officials about the CIA's assessment, in part because some questions remain unanswered.
Sure. Sure.
So they, don't know if the Kremlin directed this. Right?
Yeah, but when the guy says this is not true, and he's only participating in even one out of six intelligence briefing, who is telling him that this is not true? The same people who told him that there were 3 million illegal aliens who voted in the election.
The question is it not true because it's not true, or because you don't want it to be true? But this probably explains why Obama said, let's have an investigation now, and you're going to have to report to me in the next few weeks because I'm going to be out of here on January 19th.
And so are many of you, probably.
And so are many of you.
In the intelligence community.
Yeah.
Now, that's the risk.
So, okay. So let's ask the next two questions. First of all, what do you do if they come back and say, yeah, no, it's true? I mean, I don't know what they're going to do that's different. They've already said it's true. What are you going to do? How do you, what's a response to that? You can't fix it. As you say, Devendra, we're in a situation where we have no.
This is uncharted territory.
Precedent. No. What is the response? Yeah. You can't do the election over.
I mean, you could. There's.
This is something the founding fathers did not anticipate.
I mean, either it's all up to the electors or I don't know, like. I could see some sort of other type
the electors
of
vote. The electors vote in 5 days or whatever. It's the 19th.
Oh, man.
So I don't think that. And I also think, you know, a number of states have said and have laws, probably unconstitutional laws, but laws that say the electors will be prosecuted if they're faithless, if they don't vote as they've been told to. So I wouldn't anticipate any reaction from the Electoral College. It's too soon and it's illegal in some cases. And I'm sure there's probably debate, internal debate over all this. So
in most cases, the electors were chosen because they were they were a slate that supported the candidate.
Right.
And so they're among the most enthusiastic supporters there. So the likelihood that you're going to get enough of them to flip and vote their conscience on an issue like this is unrealistic. So no, so I'd say two things. Number one, it's a genuine constitutional crisis because, as you say, the founders didn't know about Twitter. They didn't know about fake news. They knew about fake news, but they didn't know about Facebook fake news.
Right.
They didn't know that. The other thing though, that I think is the more likely outcome of all this is that the incoming administration is about to discover the power of entrenched bureaucracies, which are capable of acting independently. When you have hundreds of thousands of people within an organization, you can bring in a few new people at the top. But I don't want to replace them wholesale.
I don't want to conflate. So a lot of people in the chat are saying it's over. Trump won. I don't want to conflate a political debate over who won or who should have won with the appropriate conversation we should have about if we're being hacked by a foreign nation, what do we do about it? That's the technical conversation. So let's I would hope we would still have this debate. No matter who won the election, that it's not a matter of, oh, we don't like the result, let's figure out a way to overturn it. It is not that. It is, what do we do if a foreign nation has the capability of doing this? How do we respond? Now, the capability first of all, is not traditional hacking in the sense that they maybe hacked the voting machines. It's a case of them, it's propaganda, frankly, of them hacking both the DNC and RNC, looking for information from both, and then selectively using WikiLeaks, releasing the information that was in favor of one candidate against another. That's kind of an indirect way of influencing the election. Although there is a larger concern that maybe they got something from the RNC that they can use against the RNC.
Right.
And blackmail them. I don't know. So there's a national security issue at stake here that goes well beyond who won the election, who didn't win the election. So I don't want this to be people to miss. It would be a mistake for us to act as if, and people from people to misinterpret it as if we're saying, oh well, Hillary should have won. It's not that. It's really a question of, well, what's going on? If Russian government actors, and the way they do this, by the way, is not direct. This is part of the debate inside the intelligence services, as I understand it, is not whether the Kremlin did it or not, because they use third parties. They use Guccifer 2.0 so that they can have plausible deniability. But really, whether if any nation tries to influence us, how do we defend against it?
Right. And this is tough, too, because even if we do a redo vote, you know, in that miraculous event, the damage has already been done. You know, right.
That's exactly what you don't want to do. That may even be better for Mushroom. Maybe. Great. We got turmoil now.
Then we have turmoil. And it's also like we've also seen in this entire campaign, facts and truth hasn't had much of an effect either, especially when it comes to Trump. They sort of bounce off of him. It's going to be strange.
See, unfortunately, and the chat room has completely gone off. There's some guy who's changed his handle to the sore losers.
This is why we have to close comments whenever we write about hacking or Trump or anything.
So let me ask you, those of you say, oh, you're sore losers. Is this not a legitimate conversation no matter what happened in the election?
Precisely.
Is this not a legitimate conversation? Should we not be concerned about foreign governments hacking? Are you saying, oh, it didn't happen? Or are you saying, oh, you're just sore losers, we won, get over it? Which is, by the way, those are the two sentences that came from the Trump campaign.
And the reality is that if this had happened, if let's say that the situation was reversed and Hillary Clinton won and we got the same report.
Let's
pretend that happened. We would be having this exact conversation.
I would hope so. Yes.
I know that we would. And if anything, it would be the fervor would be 10 times harder, where we would actually probably be having more of a substantive conversation about what this means for the future, rather than the very same people who are saying the sore loser talk would be leading the opposition to do as thorough as an investigation as possible and talking about as you've all been saying, like the broader implications of a different state interfering with our election. That's a very, very serious issue. Regardless, like take the politics out of it. That right there is something that's problematic and is troubling and is something that should be definitely investigated. And I don't know what we can do about it, but certainly
we can't stop it.
Exactly.
It's pretty clear that we can't stop anybody from hacking. we're basically helpless in the face of governmental hackers, just by the way, as they are in the face of our hackers, right? Is that not the case?
Pretty much.
Software is imperfect. Okay, let's see if we can do this in a logical proof. Software is imperfect. Agreed? We stipulate that.
Sure.
Imperfect software will always have some form of exploitable security flaw. Can we stipulate that?
Sure.
A state actor determined enough with enough resources. Resources, including their own intelligence, but also the ability to spend millions of dollars on other hacking teams and security companies buying exploits. That's really where I think a lot of this comes from. If you have millions of dollars to spend, you can gain these exploits. This is the question we ask on Security Now all the time. Is it possible to fully secure anything? Now, obviously, Sony Pictures Entertainment was not secure, but we were able to point fingers at an IT team that basically said, oh, security, but that's not worth the money.
We don't care.
Actually, it wasn't the IT team. It was the management said, we don't care.
It's the CIO. So it was
the CIO.
Both.
Yeah. But then I look at, okay, here's my example that I think is a telling example. Sheldon Adelson, very wealthy man, right? Runs the back end casino operations for many casinos in Vegas. Macau is where he made all of his money. Lots of money, presumably virtually unlimited resources. And Iranian hackers were able to hack the Sands back end, which ran the casino operations in many of the casinos in Vegas, and steal from it. Now, if you can hack a guy who has unlimited funds and a very strong motivation to secure the back end of the casino operations, I saw Ocean's 11. This is stuff that you don't hack. If they can't do it, I basically feel like it's can't be done, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a geometric proof that we're screwed.
any software. Well,
so here's, I don't know, my take on it is strip the election results out of it to take away the,
because there's this big emotional thing going on. So we don't want
right.
that.
It becomes an emotional response and a distraction. Historically, large nations have had spies. It's been just what gentlemen did for hundreds of years. You use spies to get information so that you could make better decisions, so that you could know what your enemy was thinking, what your friends were thinking, even. It's one thing to get information and use that information to make decisions. It's another thing to get information and use that information to influence the course of business or the course of government. So I would take the example. Imagine that the Russians had hacked, say, ExxonMobil, and that they had then used the information to compromise contracts with ExxonMobil, making it easier for a Russian company to win a lucrative multi-billion-dollar contract. What would the American response be in that case? I hope we would be outraged at the fact that a foreign nation was interfering with what we like to think of as the free market.
Well, I mean, but again, can we do anything about it? And do we
sure,
have
there's
the will?
Things that we, sure, there's things that can be done, but they're the same kinds of things that have been done to spies behind the scenes for years, and you don't read about them until typically 30 or 40 years later, after the classification on it expires and most of the people involved in it are dead, and the handful who are left can talk about it. But this is just a different dimension for the same kind of activities that have been going on as long as people have been running governments.
Right.
Yeah, that's a very good point. We've actually seen, I think, a lot of recent spy movies. That's kind of been the plot, right? Of like getting the information out there, making it public.
Right.
And they just assume all hell will break loose. And that's kind of what's happening, too.
Well, I'm gonna end the conversation because everybody says you're talking politics. We're absolutely not, but this is part of the reason why this conversation isn't going to go much farther, is because people have decided that that's politics, and it's not. It's about
la la la.
I'm not hearing you because you're talking politics. It's not. It's about whether a foreign nation or, frankly, us. Whether it's cyber warfare, and I think that we need to think about that. And if you who listen to this show don't think about it, I guarantee you nobody else is going to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing to say to those people is, look, the people who are making that argument that this is all politics, you say, look, the fact that the actors on the other end of this operation have managed to wrap this up in politics so that we can't respond to it in a traditional and rational way is part of the problem, a very large part of the problem. And somebody has to step up, and it's going to take people from multiple sides to be able to say we need to be in a non-political approach to this. But there are national security implications involved and a hell of a lot of technology, which is why we're talking about it here.
But don't worry, because we're going to get to more important things like why the AirPods are delayed and everything will be fine. don't worry about it. We're done now. I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Russia. That's why, Leo.
Russia. That's why the it's Russia. Hey, I'd like to be friends with Russia. Wouldn't you like to be? I mean, what's wrong with that? Nothing wrong with that. Let's be friends with Russia. Maybe when if we're friends, they will stop messing with us.
Sure. That'll totally work.
I you know what?
It's moving right along.
There is a really interesting conversation, and we won't have it today. But there is a really interesting conversation about whether we have entered a new era. A couple of things have created this situation, but a post-fact era. Where partly caused by the internet's ability to create a filter bubble around whatever you want to believe, combined with just kind of an onslaught of information that is very difficult to vet. So essentially every piece of information, true or not, has equal weight. The lack of, and this is an interesting thing, you know, when I was growing up, there was kind of a national consciousness because we all watched the same TV shows at the same time because you couldn't tape them. And so when people would come into work and talk about what Johnny Carson said last night, or you would have all been watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. So there was this kind of interesting situation where the national conversation was kind of, we were all talking about the same things. Now, I don't know if that's a good thing or not. I think you can make a strong case that wasn't such a good thing. Because who was controlling that conversation? But now we're having 1,000 different conversations, and you basically decide which bubble you want to be in, and you join that bubble, and you don't hear anything else. And I do think that we're kind of entering this post-fact era, and I don't know what that looks like in the future. I mean, you hear terms like moral relativism. Well, now we have factual relativism.
Reality relativism.
Yeah. What is that? And what is the end game there? What does that end up looking like? Where we're, are we all in our own
idiocracy?
Well, it does look a little bit like idiocracy, or maybe it looks like WALL-E, where we're all riding around in our floating chairs with our VR helmets, experiencing our own personal reality that has nothing to do with real reality. Mm-hmm. But what is real reality?
Yeah. I think we're at a point where, like, I think librarians and people who study that sort of thing, that sort of like media training, because I remember back in high school and college, like, that was kind of where you started learning about, you know, good sources, you know, how to find a good source for your reports and everything. And I wonder if we need to have that at a national level. Maybe taught alongside civics, which is also not taught that much anymore in high school. But yeah, there's so much stuff going on. Information is moving so quickly, and we kind of have to teach people to be aware of that and figure things out.
You know, it's not that propaganda is anything. There's anything new about propaganda. Right. There's not that, you know, fake news is not new. No, but that fake news goes back to hundreds and hundreds of years. But what's different is the power and ability to spread this information, the ability that people have to choose an isolated, you know, to put themselves. I poo-pooed the filter bubble for years because I said, well, come on. You know, ultimately, the internet gives you so much information. Some variety of information is going to leak through. You always have at least the opportunity. And in many cases, regardless of your choice, you're going to get other points of view. Now I'm starting to think maybe that's not true. Maybe we really, we live in the world we want to believe in and live in. The reality we choose. Isn't that what all of this technology is kind of pointing us to, is choose your own reality?
Let me retweet this and maybe you'll see it. But there was a study.
I don't go to Twitter because it's not true.
I just retweeted this.
I blame Twitter for a lot of this, but go ahead. All right, I'll read your
tweet. There was a study that the MIT Media Lab did of the bubbles that you're talking about, and there's an interesting visualization that they did. Did it show up there? It's from Reality Matters.
What's your Twitter handle?
Edbot.
That's easy.
Yeah.
Not film_boy.
Come on, Apple.
Yeah, Clinton and Trump supporters live in their own Twitter worlds, and they did.
Oh, I saw this. I saw this. Yeah. And this, so they have a cloud of, what are these sources? What are these dots? So the red dots are follow only Trump. The blue dots are follow only Clinton. The purple dots follow both The gray dots follow neither. And then this is, I'm not sure I really fully understand this, but that's interesting.
Well, there's a, if you look at, you know, the more solid the color,
the better.
Is, the more, well, the more of a bubble
right.
you see.
Right, right.
The better for the bubble.
The better for the bubble. And I think, and there were several people who criticized this graphic, you know, saying there's actually a fair amount of
purple.
That goes all the way to the to the left. But the really interesting thing there is that bright red thing. And this aligns with the thing that we heard from the these kids in Macedonia who were making, you know, $30,000 a month building fake news sites. They said we were building, you know, it.
This is who we were targeting.
That's where all the, money was.
And what's interesting is they tried targeting these people over here and it didn't make them much money.
They said we would put something out there and it would get debunked in 5 minutes and then nobody would retweet it.
I feel like this is the future. I feel like this is susceptible to propaganda is the future.
Right.
This is it's not just going to be all of us at some point. This is where Twitter and Facebook and everybody are pointing us. Isn't it?
I mean, I think it depends on a lot of things.
It's self-feeding, and that's the thing. If you've ever played Conway's Life or whatever, or Osmo, this looks like Osmo. It's self-feeding. It gets bigger and bigger, and there's some point where it just becomes the universe.
I mean, I think even on the on Hillary's camp, there were certainly bubbles of conversation too. Like,
absolutely.
There was a lot of talk about the whole Pantsuit Nation like Facebook group, which I can understand why people were excited about it. I also feel like that's not as useful as broadening the conversation and making the entire country aware.
I followed on Facebook. I followed every candidate. I followed all of the Republican potential nominees. I followed all the Democratic candidates.
You followed the transhumanist candidate, Liam?
I got everybody because I wanted to get everybody in my feed. But it's interesting because I have a feeling Facebook, in fact, I can guarantee it, modified it so that even though I was following all of those, Facebook watched my tendencies. Which stories do you read? And not in an attempt to propagandize me at all, but an attempt to maximize my time spent viewing gave me more of what I liked. So even if you try, you get funneled in based on what you read.
This is a problem for journalists.
Same thing, right?
Yeah.
Right. I'm
doing it right now. The chat room saying, oh, you're political. Get off this subject. So I'm ready to move on. That's what happens.
We're talking about the tech around politics. Okay.
I know. But I'm influenced too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard not to be influenced by your viewership.
Yep.
Give them what they want.
The thing is, there have definitely been some valid complaints against how the social algorithms are leading us when it comes to news. But these sites were never meant to be news readers, right? They're not like Google Reader used to be or an RSS reader. It's not just pure data. So,
I don't know. I think that's giving them a little bit more of a break than they deserve because it became very quickly, very early on, as soon as they started accepting, Twitter especially, and I think Facebook, as soon as they had the news feed and started allowing other links into it, I think that you have to start considering, and once you start making algorithmic changes based on what people will see and what they'll like and you start personalizing things, I think that those companies, they can't just say they're tech companies, because they are media companies,
I know you're not. Yeah. I'm talking about the function of a news reader, like an RSS reader versus a social feed. And a social feed is inherently algorithmic.
Yeah, I think it's time to stop using Facebook for news. And that's a big... Yeah.
But most people won't do that. That's the problem, right?
No, We're stuck with this situation. Frankly, more to the point, the media industry, and I think all of us included, we rely on Facebook for a good
portion of our traffic. That's where your links come from.
It's where your links come from. It's where people find you. And so it's easy to say we should stop relying on Facebook for news. But the reality is it's a big part of Facebook's business. Yeah. And it's a big and Facebook is a big part of the news's business.
It's really an interesting it's a very open-ended conversation because I don't think there's any answers or certainly no easy answers to any of this. And I do think we're entering a different era. And I do think that Twitter and Facebook have a lot to be responsible for. I really do. Maybe less so Twitter, because Twitter inevitably is a little more diverse. It's Facebook that really so actively cultivates the feed.
Well, but Twitter, I would say, you choose who you follow. So Twitter, in some ways, it's more diverse, but in a lot of ways, you explicitly choose who you follow. So they don't, although they do it now in the mobile app, you know, they have historically not done what Facebook does, which is personalize the feed and kind of determine what you should see. They haven't made those sorts of judgments, although, again, they are doing it in the mobile app. But instead, it's become much more self-selected. So, you know, depending on who you follow, that's what you see. So in some ways, you know, they haven't had to answer as many of the questions that Facebook has, because, you know, Facebook, so many people share so many different things, and you can, you know, if you like one thing, it can... Yeah, I don't know. I just see it. They're slightly different, but yeah.
Huh. Well, we always knew that technology and the internet would change the world. We just maybe didn't really understand how much.
Right. Well, it's kind of a reckoning now, right? It's, they got what they wanted. Like, Facebook is our de facto solution for being social online, except, now you have civic responsibilities, and you better step up to those. Yeah.
Now, exactly. It's like Facebook wanted to be the internet. Now it is. You have to deal with the responsibilities that come along with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have also the conflict that started out in the early days of the internet, of the web anyway, with which is better, an algorithmic, completely mechanical presentation of information, or a curated presentation of information, like the old Yahoo lists and the original Moz feeds, you know, things that were where you had experts do those. And that was fine when the web was 4,000 pages. It's literally impossible now. But the reality is that Facebook has become a huge newspaper that publishes a new edition every 20 microseconds. And there have to be human editors involved in that process, even if they're just backstopping the algorithms to avoid things going wrong.
I always thought that this would be a self-correcting system. Mm-hmm. I was a fool.
I really wasn't. Because they rely on humans, too, you know.
Well, I just thought, you know, there was enough sources and there was enough this and that it would self-correct. And what I've realized is quite the opposite. We've reached a tipping point and a point of no return, frankly.
After the whole Pizzagate thing, it's like...
There's a really good example.
How could anybody believe that? And it's gotten to a point where a guy brings a gun into a freaking pizza shop. Yeah. It's insane.
Right. Becomes a real problem. And I think what we also mean, I think we thought it might be self-correcting, but it also turns out that there is a financial incentive to create fake news, which I don't think a lot of people saw coming. I know I certainly didn't, that there would be as much of a financial incentive.
Yeah, but we did, because it's just the next step of link bait.
Sure, right. I guess. But
we kind of saw this coming, really.
Well, I mean, I guess, but it seems... There's a difference, I think, between link bait and spam and purposely setting up, pseudo newsrooms where people just write ridiculous stories that are literally meant to appeal.
That's what they did. They made fun. That's what Upworthy does for a living. Yeah. By the way, Upworthy, set up by Eli Pariser, who wrote the book about the filter bubble. He figured it out and then said, good, let's make some money.
But I guess my point is there seems to be a difference, though, between Upworthy and that sort of level of clickbait versus literally hiring people to write stories that are not only completely made up, but are made up and are designed to appeal to a very specific audience so that you can get the advertising and you can get people to share it. You can make it go viral.
I'm not sure I understand the distinction.
That's very interesting to me.
But I think one of the things, go ahead. Okay. Well, one of the things that we've learned, though, in all these years is that any tool that you put out there is going to be abused by completely amoral actors as quickly as possible. So that's how we got viruses. That's how we got ransomware. That's how we got advertising scams. And so it was completely predictable if you look at the evolution of who used the technology out there. The only difference between journalists like you know, those of us on these screens here and these fake news guys is that we have a, you know, a professional code and morals where we actually have a line that we draw where we say, OK, I can't do that. I can do this. Yeah. And gee, I want this to be a really sexy headline. And I know maybe it's slightly misleading.
We're just old fashioned. That's just old fashioned.
Well, I mean, but
scruples are forget scruples. That's old fashioned. That's old folks.
Yeah.
Well, we have reputation at least scruples. That we want to protect.
Oh, yeah. The journalistic code. Yeah. That's just, you know, that's go back to the front page. That's 19.
But to what we were talking about earlier, I think even more so than like clickbaity headlines, you could look at like the Taboola links.
And, that's what I'm thinking exactly. Taboola and Outbrain.
Like the garbage that has basically cluttered the internet and we've grown so used to it and big publishers are making money off of it. I think, you know, my site is, a whole bunch of sites are.
Ad tech is.
We've grown used to that. And that's I think, a bigger problem.
Yeah.
When it comes to
the
there was a story on the New York Times today that was about like fake news. And there was an ad for like a fake ad about saying like Alec Baldwin had died.
Yep.
And that happens a lot, you know, and that's just because of the ad.
And then it ended up, he didn't really die. He's taking a diet pill that you should be taking also.
Yeah.
Right.
And watch this gallery.
On the page, there was an interesting Medium article the other day on the page on Facebook where Zuckerberg says, you know, we've been doing soul searching about this fake news thing and we're trying to come up with solutions, but we don't think it, you know, influenced the election, blah, blah, blah. Somebody, you know, did a screenshot of that
fake news.
Zuckerberg's article with two fake news ads next to it. I mean, it was just like you can't get any more perfect than that. And there, ultimately, when you get down to it, all of this technology is being monetized in ways that if you take the morality out of it and you take the controls. Quality controls out of it, you end up where we are now.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I don't know if we're ever going back to the good old days, but sure was fun when it lasted.
I'm going to move to Macedonia.
Actually, it's a beautiful country. It's really gorgeous. Highly recommend it. All right, let's take a break. And we have spent a lot of time on this. And I think really good conversation. I mean, I don't think it's the end of this conversation. I think a lot about this, and I don't know what the answer is. I really don't. But I don't know if there is. I don't know if there's anything you can do about it. Aside from censorship or something, nobody wants that. I don't think there's anything you can do.
Need a smarter population. That's what we need.
Well, we are what we are. We're human, and so we're going to get that. That's what we're going to get. We're going to get humans. And it's like you gave a kid a nuclear weapon and then you're shocked that he used it.
Now you're talking about the Trump presidency.
Okay. Now that was political.
Why are we laughing? Let's not laugh at that.
There's nothing to laugh at.
It's terrifying.
But it's like that. We're humans. There's no, you know, it's not like there's 10% of humans are bad and the rest are good. We all have 10% bad, I think. Some are really bad, but I mean, we all have a little bit of bad in us. And we just gave ourselves tools, and then we're surprised that what happened was, you know, we all end up throwing excrement at the monkey cage. I don't know. It's very interesting. But, Ed, you and I, and I think Christina and Devendra, we're going to uphold journalistic standards and integrity. I've really felt like that's important. And my kid wants to be, he's 22, he's in college, he wants to be a journalist. And I'm continually kind of feeding him this line. Mm-hmm. And I hope his professors are too, about journalistic integrity and the rules and you owe it to your readers. You owe it to, you know, that this, you know, there's a way to do it. And he's getting the AP style guide and legal manual for Christmas. And I just, you know, I'm hoping. Just hope.
That brings literally a tear to my eye. It does.
Jim Lauterbach, way back when we at Tech TV, wrote a statement of ethics, and he was really, I really will always honor Jim for doing this. And he went around in our studio and he taped over every brand name. Huh. I mean, it's very old fashioned. But he was really right on. He came from the old Ziff Davis days where there was this kind of standard, and it was beat into you. you know. Let's take a break. We have a great panel here. Devinder Hardwar from Engadget, where he is a senior editor, senior writer for Gizmodo. Christina Warren is here. I love all of you guys. I think we should. I just want to shut the rest of the world out and hang with you guys. Just chill with you guys. And Ed Bott, my old friend from ZDNet, known Ed 20 plus years now.
20, yeah, it's at least 25.
You were editor in chief of Windows Magazine, right?
PC Computing.
PC Computing, that's it. When we, Jaborak and I used to have you on the radio show way back when.
I think that was one of my first computer magazines too. So yeah,
great. I love PC Computing. Always loved PC.
It was a great magazine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are there any magazines anymore at all? I mean, computer magazines.
I don't think so.
I go to the airport and I see them.
Count.
Wired, okay. Yeah, they're,
does that count?
Yeah. They still do.
I mean,
print.
Kind of. Because it's culture, really, as much as anything else. But like the hardcore
PC magazines gone. PC Computing long gone. Mm-hmm. Windows magazines.
Laptop is still around, right?
Laptop.
So laptop mag.
Okay, there you go.
They have a thing.
Why?
People like laptops. I don't know. Wired, man. I hope Wired, they get back more into tech. Yeah.
All right. Ed's going to call us back while we do a little break here. We want to talk about my mattress. Hey, at least I sleep well at night thanks to Casper. That's important. Get a good night's sleep on your Casper mattress. There are some amazing things the internet has brought us, and this is an example of... You don't have to go to a mattress store and lie on a mattress in broad daylight with a salesperson staring at you going, get your shoes off my mattress, let alone, you know, rolling around, maybe bringing your honey and doing a little smooching. You don't get to test a mattress at the mattress store. As a result, you get it home and, well, good luck. With Casper, you're testing your mattress at home for 100 days. You get a great deal on a mattress that's obsessively engineered in the United States for outrageous comfort. It's really, they comes in a very compact box. You open it up, smells beautiful. It breathes. You sleep cool at night. It's comfortable and you will love it. It is literally changing the way people shop for mattresses. Look, they got a dog mattress. It's so cute. I want you to go to Casper.com and check out these amazing Casper mattresses. If you decide you want to get one, I'm going to get you $50 off the mattress. Starts with $500 for a queen all the way up to Cal King size. $50 off when you use the offer code TWIT. You got to go to Casper.com/TWIT. It is a trial. So if even in 100 nights, you say, yeah, they will come and they will get it. You don't have to fit it back in the box, I promise. They will come, they will get it, they will take it away and refund you every penny. The design story behind the Casper is fascinating. They spent a lot of time, did a great many prototypes, 108 prototypes, 100 plus formulations. They were looking for firmness, airflow, density, transition temperature, rebound speed, and odor. I swear to God, these things are important. And I have to tell you, they got it right. But you don't have to take my word for it. You can try it. And if it's not perfect for you, you got plenty of time to return it. Designing the perfect mattress, Casper.com.
You should spend a long time. Just
slash twit. There's the co-founder lying on the mattress. That's the testing right there. Casper.com/twit. Use the offer code TWIT for $50 off. Terms and conditions apply. You will love your Casper mattress. We're talking tech. Hey, the latest thing, and I wasn't joking, is the EarPods.
AirPods.
Mm-hmm. Apple's AirPods. Remember that was I don't know if it was real or fake. Was it on Gizmodo?
I have a pair.
Yeah, everybody has a pair. The journalists have the pre-production yeah. pair.
Yes, we do.
But they're not in the stores. And I think this is a big deal since Apple took the headphone jack out.
Mm-hmm.
You got to think they want to get these AirPods out into the market. But does anybody know where they are and why?
Yeah, the closest report, so there's a Wall Street Journal story that basically says that they were having it. it kind of conflates a few things. It kind of makes some suppositions about the fact there might have been some manufacturing problems, which John Gruber's sources kind of confirms that they've had a hard time kind of mass producing them. And then the journal goes on to kind of suppose they might have had some issues getting the two pieces to independently talk to one another, because how AirPods work versus a lot of other fully wireless earbuds is that each bud has an individual wireless signal to your phone, rather than how a lot of them work. Not all of them. Some of them do what Apple's doing as well. But how a lot of them work is that you pair, one is paired to your phone and the other is paired to the other bud. And so that can lead to some lagging.
Have you noticed that on yours?
No, my AirPods, they're fine. But what I found with other purely wireless headphones is that they can have a lag issue, because one of them is paired to the left ear is paired to the right ear and the right ear is paired to the phone. And in the case of AirPods, they're both paired to the phone. So they both have an independent signal coming. And so the journal story intimates and says that it's possible that they could have had a problem with some of the radio stuff and the Bluetooth stack. I guess that's possible. The pre-production ones, which they gave to journalists, which are obviously not the ones that have been mass produced, have been fine. I mean,
nobody I know you has had a problem with them.
So what John Gruber's sources have told him is that it's been more of a mass production issue, which could make some sense. I think that this is a different type of product for them, and they might have run into some production problems. Regardless of whatever the reason is, it certainly is not great that
three months
and that was touted, that it was supposed to be out in late October and was then delayed, you're not going to have it out in time for Christmas.
That's a bigger deal, right? Because this is a perfect stocking stuffer, even at $150.
Oh, it's a perfect stocking stuffer. Yeah. And for a lot of people, they want them. Gruber sources say manufacturing problems at scale. It doesn't matter what the reason is. The reality is we're not going to get them in time for Christmas, or, barring some sort of miracle, they're not going to be done in the next, 2 weeks. I think that Apple had introduced them, obviously, right, as kind of a way, I think, to lessen the sting of getting rid of the headphone jack. Mm-hmm. In all honesty, I think that most people who have an iPhone 7 haven't really had that much. I know I haven't had a problem. It's one of those things that the included adapter worked well, and I actually got a pair of new Bluetooth headphones recently that have the W10 chip.
Oh, really?
So
somebody's making W1 headphones.
Yeah, W1 headphones. Beats is. So you can get the Beats Solo 3s, and you can get the Beats X. But they have two pairs. They have two of them available. And that chip is fantastic.
So let me ask you this, and I don't know if you noticed this, but in my opinion, Bluetooth headphones do not sound as good as wired headphones. There's a compression that just doesn't, that it's, the music isn't as open. It doesn't feel as good. It's fine for voice.
I think that it depends on the pair of headphones. I think that there are certainly...
I have a $400 pair of Sennheiser Bluetooth headphones, because I said, well, maybe you're right. Maybe it's just because I'm buying cheap Bluetooth headphones, and I bought a lot of them, including Beats. Yeah. And so I said, well, let's get the top of the line. The most expensive ones I could find were the Sennheisers. Everybody raves about them. Same exact thing. There's some sort of... It's not, and that makes sense, because they don't have a lot of bandwidth. They got to compress it a little bit. So
it depends on the source too, right? Because if you connect those to a MacBook, for some reason OS X it has aptX support for Bluetooth, but iOS doesn't.
Oh, so listen, because aptX is supposed to be better. Is it better?
It's a little better. Yeah, it makes it's less compression and higher quality all around.
Okay, I'll try that. I'll do it on my MacBook.
Okay. What I find sometimes, I would say that a $400 pair of wired headphones are certainly going to sound better than a $400 pair of Bluetooth headphones. But a decent pair of Bluetooth headphones will probably sound every bit as good as, a decent pair.
Let's face it. You're selling into a market of kids that have been wearing the included earbuds on their iPhones for years. They don't know this.
Without a doubt. I mean, and the Beats... I love them because they're great Subway phones, and I like them for the fashion. I would never say that they're the best audio quality. I buy them. I buy them because they're rose gold, and now the new ones have 40-hour battery life.
Wait a minute, you bought them because they're rose gold?
Absolutely. I bought my last pair last year, and I spent another $300 this year to get the upgraded pair.
Do you wear them with the Snapchat spectacles?
I mean, that's a little much. I mean, okay.
Come on.
Probably.
When am I going to see you on the F line wearing the Snapchat and the blue and the thing?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I hate myself, but yeah.
They're your Subway. These are my Subway headphones. I don't wear these.
They are, though.
Subway headphones are great because, yeah, you don't want any cords to tangle you, and there's going to be a lot of noise, right? So it's not like a high-quality audio experience. Yeah. You just need something loud to block out everybody else.
Right.
I
can you also get like nose clips so you can't smell everybody else?
You need that.
Sometimes you do.
Yeah. I love the situation where I like go into a train car and with everyone else, everyone takes a sniff and just backs out.
It's an empty car. There's one guy sleeping on the thing, and then it's, the rest of the car is empty. Yeah. And their other cars are jammed. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And everybody's like, you see it come across, and you're like, oh, empty car. And then you step on, and you're like, nope.
Too good to be true.
I think if you live long enough in New York, you lose the sense of smell for urine. It just doesn't, you can't smell it anymore.
I don't know. I feel like I smell it more in San Francisco. Yeah.
Oh, you're right. I shouldn't. Yeah. I'm not. You're right. Absolutely.
Honestly, I've seen a lot more like stuff in San Francisco.
And the sad thing about San Francisco is the homeless encampment is in the City Hall, park there, right in front of City Hall. That's where everybody lives. So
it's a sad situation.
Yeah, it's a sad situation. I don't know what's
going on. Back to like talking about the Apple stuff, like why did we lose the headphone jack in the first place? It was for a bigger, was it the touch thing, right? The 3D
touch processor, whatever.
And
yeah.
Who cares? Like what added functionality did that? I know it added some nice new like tactile features when you're scrolling through menus in iOS 10, but otherwise who cares? I think most people would have rather kept plugging in their headphones
I agree with you. My conspiracy theory, which is in no way based on any sort of reporting that I have at all, so it's complete conspiracy. Want to just put that out there? But my theory is that they did it this time because for the big redesigned phone that we're supposed to get, they needed the space.
My theory is the Russians did it. It's all the Russians' fault.
My theory was get everybody ticked off this time and let them get it out of their system. Yeah.
And then next year in the iPhone 8, that will not get the attention it would have gotten if they'd waited till
exactly.
Next year.
They didn't want it to take away from this beautiful redesign with all this other stuff they're doing. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is how fake news is made.
She just made that up.
You just watched it.
But it's plausible.
I'm going to go tweet that right now.
Don't tweet it yet because I have an opposing viewpoint. Because who is the number one Bluetooth headphone manufacturer in the world?
Beats.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they get rid of the headphone jack. Who does that benefit? Bluetooth headphone manufacturers. And if Apple could just get their gosh darn Bluetooth headphones out the door.
Right, seriously.
Profit. So I think there's two motives. I think, you know what's really sad? I think you're going to see other companies do the same thing now because they're slaves to Apple. And Apple got rid of it, it must be the right thing to do.
I reviewed, so who was it? It was Motorola who didn't have it on one of their phones.
The Z doesn't have a headphone jack.
The Z doesn't have it. And then I reviewed Echo, however you say their name.
Echo?
Le Echo.
It's Chinese, and they have a French name.
Yeah, and sometimes they say Lico. I don't know. Anyway, I reviewed their S Pro 3 or whatever, and that has USB-C. So it comes with these earphones that look just like ear pods, like they look identical to ear pods, but it has a USB-C jack instead. And, the rumor is that the S8 is going to not have the headphone jack after Samsung, made hay about, our phone has the headphone jack, but the S8 is reportedly not going to have it either. So, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, people just follow the...
Wow.
They just follow Apple.
Follow the leader. Wow. Yeah. It seems like... this is like one of many like anti-consumer moves I think Apple has been making lately. Like there are arguments to be made too about like the new MacBook Pros and how disappointing those are as upgrades, lacking other ports that people may need, or the touch bar. And it's like, who, like, is that going to be as useful as people think versus...
Yeah. My experience, you know, I don't know, I'd love to hear what you think, but my experience with the Touch Bar, which I thought, I mean, it has a high cool factor because it's OLED.
It's very cool. It's
and the Touch ID is great. I like that.
Touch
I think
ID
that's really
awesome.
Good. But I never use the track bar because I don't, it's always different and I have to look down to see what it is this day. And yeah. I don't find it useful, so I just don't use it.
Yeah, there's certain apps I use it in, but most apps I don't. And I think that, and was what I wrote in my review was basically like, it could become useful. It's really going to depend on third party to support. And unfortunately, that comes kind of like comes down to like Force Touch.
I kind of think it doesn't ever become useful because it's just, you know, we're all taught to touch type, to not look at the keyboard.
Right.
That's what Miss Krasinski told me in ninth grade. Do not look at the keyboard. And so I'm looking at the screen and there's nothing. And so I'm not looking down at the keyboard.
But nobody's taught to type anymore. I think people just kind of get with it. Like I know a lot of people, young people who don't type properly. They're still doing two fingers too. So it's kind of tough. But I guess my bigger issue is that they spent so much time on that touch bar and not on like actual functional things that professional users may want in a MacBook Pro. That's where it's getting kind of worrisome. Like just having the USB-C ports, which love that you can't even connect, you know, the iPhone to it. So,
by the way,
those sorts of things are ridiculous.
Do you like the Le Echo Le S3?
It's fine.
I mean, it's cheap. It's $250.
It's very cheap. And so here's the thing. I did a battle between that and the OnePlus 3T. And
which
the OnePlus
really
3T.
Nice.
Is because their specs are almost identical, and the OnePlus 3T is a better phone.
Okay.
But it also can cost, you know, in some cases $150 more. Is right. $150 better? No, I think the S3 Pro or the S Pro 3 is a very nice phone. I don't love some of the the Le Pro 3. I'm wrong.
Le Pro 3.
They have an S3 Pro or something that's even cheaper, but the Le Pro 3 can sell for, you know, like
$399.
But is often available for $300 because they have this like Le Rewards program. And so for a $300 phone, I think it's very good. There's some software things I don't love about it. I think that like I would definitely install a different launcher on it for one
thing. I always
thing.
Do though on every phone I
but,
get. I do.
But I think that in terms of everything else, I mean, it's a very good performing phone.
Big battery.
Very big battery. It's got basically the same specs as a Pixel. And, that's impressive. So I think that
for a few hundred bucks less.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that for a lot of people, like you get the Pixel, you know, because you want to be part of, you know, get the pure Google experience and all of that. But I certainly wouldn't think that it would be worth spending more than twice as much.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's why so many of these Chinese companies are starting to really impinge on the market that, you know, Samsung and LG and HTC have historically had with phones that instead of being $650, $750, they're selling for $299 to $399. Where from a functional hardware point of view, they're almost identical.
Yeah, I really love the Axon 7 from ZTE. That was one of my favorite.
Yeah, that's nice.
Beautiful phones. Yeah.
And
I think
the
OnePlus 3T is fantastic.
The OnePlus 3T is great. Like I would in some cases recommend like the OnePlus 3T over the Pixel. Just because I don't think that the Google Assistant is that useful yet.
That camera is great.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Pixel's my daily driver right now. And funnily enough, the smaller Pixel. Not the bigger one, but it's funny. It doesn't inspire in any way when you look at it. It's kind of
right.
It's just another. But there's something about it. It's a very practical, useful phone. It's a shame it's so expensive.
I kind of feel bad for HTC these days, just seeing all these other phones that have basically lifted the HTC One design from a couple years ago. Like even Apple has kind of lifted that design.
The Axon 7 looks just like an HTC One.
Exactly like
one. Yeah.
So it's really funny that the Google Pixel phones are built by HTC, but kind of echoing that design as well.
Don't look that good.
Totally.
I
kind of like it.
It's okay. Front-facing speakers, though, that's awesome. I mean, I wish they would do that. I love that. I'm going to stick with the Pixel, and I think any Android phone user should probably, just because security is a big issue now, and you want to get the updates. My Pixel already has the November 5th update. And I'm sure you can't say that of any other.
I think BlackBerry, but they're not on Nougat, so. Right. Weirdly, I mean, and by BlackBerry, I mean parentheses BlackBerry, because it's really Alcatel. And then the BlackBerry software. Right. But BlackBerry, I know, is doing a pretty good job with the software updates. They're one of the only, and you will never hear me say a nice thing about BlackBerry. I will actually give them credit for that. They are actually pushing out the security
updates. This Gooligan thing is very scary. We've been talking about this on security now. More than a million Google accounts now hacked by Gooligan, according to Checkpoint Software. They're seeing 13,000 devices breached every single day. You get it if you're using an older phone that's not up to date.
Right. It has to be like 4.4
right.
or earlier.
Right. But that's the vast majority of Android phones, though.
Right.
I mean, and you still have to do a bad thing. You have to go to a third-party store and download an app.
But still, so many people in parts of the world where they don't use the Google Store do that. Right. I mean, so,
right.
you know, and I guess this was not to go back all the way to our earlier discussion. This is why I get annoyed when, like, Verizon won't issue an update, because this is the problem with Android. You know, Google made that deal with basically letting the carriers, you know, worldwide have control over this stuff. And so they don't have any control, and the OEMs that matter too. So they don't have any ability to push stuff out. You know?
We got to take a break. Ed's only got half an hour left before he turns into a pumpkin. I don't want Ed to turn into a pumpkin. It happened once before. It wasn't a pretty sight.
I can go 40 minutes, but that's my thoughts. And then orange cloud.
Poof. Poof. Our show today brought to you by the best backup solution you can imagine, Carbonite Online Backup. My God, how many times do I have to tell you people, you gotta back up? I still get calls all the time from people whose hard drives died. Most often, you know, you could talk about the big disasters, you know, there's a fire, my whole business burnt down or whatever. But most of the time, it's, let's face it, human error, right? Human error. You deleted a file and you go, oops. Emptied the trash. Whoops. Carbonite Online Backup. This is the one and only defense against ransomware, against human error, against acts of God. It's cloud backup. If you go to carbonite.com, you can get it for Mac or PC. You can get it for home or office. They've got a lot of different plans. They even have a plan where you get a physical hardware device, so you have a local backup, and then it backs up to the cloud. That's, of course, for businesses. They got server backup and more. But in every case, you can try it for free, and you don't have to give them a credit card. So it's a real free trial, not one that's going to trick you into renewing or whatever. Go to carbonite.com and give it a shot. Automatic backup. You don't have to think about it. You pay once a year, or even, you know, once every 2 or 3 years if you want. And then you're just done. It's backing up whenever you're online. You can get to your stuff anytime. It's always a nice feeling. I don't like backup solutions where you can't tell. With Carbonite, you can log on to your Carbonite account on any computer and see everything. You can even download it and email it, so it's cloud storage too. They have free apps. You can do it on your devices. It's got all the features you're looking for business as well as for home. Very affordable. The home plan, $59 a year for everything on a computer. That's less than $5 a month. They have backed up 500 billion files now. More importantly, they've restored, I can't remember what the number was. It was like 5 billion files restored. That's 5 billion files that would be lost forever if people weren't using backup from Carbonite. 1.5 million homes and small businesses trust Carbonite. And all I'm asking is that you try it free. Go to carbonite.com. Do use the offer code TWIT when you do it. You'll get two free months when you buy Carbonite. You got to back it up to get it back. Do it right with Carbonite. PewDiePie, what's going on? I don't even know if we should talk about PewDiePie. He deletes his YouTube channel. No, not really. No.
He trolled us.
Okay. He trolled us.
Yeah. And honestly, he was never going to delete that channel. Come on.
No.
He makes millions of dollars a year, as far as I can tell.
He's the highest paid YouTuber. Forbes just ran their list. He's the highest paid YouTuber.
Does anybody really know what people get paid, though, on YouTube?
No, but they have, I mean, you know, Forbes is able to do their analysts the same way they do on their other lists. And so, I mean, I guess they have some, I don't know. But according, by all accounts, he's making millions. He's making millions of dollars.
I love Mashable's headline on this. Forbes 2016 list of highest paid YouTubers will make you weep.
That's such a Mashable headline.
I did cry, though.
You used to work there. You know how the sausage is made.
And I'm rolling my eyes. Love them. Love them. Love it.
So PewDiePie did is he said, my numbers are going down, and I think it's racist. I think it's because I'm white.
Oh, my God.
And that Lily Singh, she's not white, and she's getting more promotion for YouTube, so I'm going to kill my channel. But it was all just a troll, right?
Right, it was just a troll. He just deleted a secondary channel that still had a couple million subscribers, even though he never uploaded anything to it.
Must be nice
it.
To be so rich you could throw out 2 million subscribers.
Yeah, just seriously.
Like they never counted. According to Forbes, and this is, again, a guess because nobody's talking, PewDiePie made $15 million last year on his channel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's before subtracting management fees, taxes. It does include, I think, subsidiary income, right? Not just directly from YouTube videos.
Yeah, I mean, because I think it would have to come from, like, you know,
his book
and the YouTube Red series, where right. YouTube is definitely paying him a lot for that. And right. You know, all the sponsors, the direct ad stuff that he's able to do in addition to the AdSense stuff.
Right. AdSense, I can't imagine, is a big chunk of that somehow. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's to me, the YouTube ads, whatever.
I can't imagine those YouTube ads are worth that much. Are they?
I think at his scale, they probably are.
Maybe they are. Yeah.
When you have I think at his scale, when you have 50 million subscribers, yeah. I think that's the whole problem though, right? Yeah. Is you have to have that scale. Right. You have to have that level of commitment for it to work. And that's why it doesn't work for most people. But I think when you have that many subscribers and any video you put up is going to get, you know, minimum of a million or a couple of million views, then you're in it's a different category.
So here are your top 10 counting backwards. Colleen Ballinger made $5 million. She does Miranda Sings. You may recognize her name. You're not going to recognize Colleen Ballinger, but you'll recognize Miranda Sings.
She's got the Netflix show, too.
Yep. Rhett and Link, of course. They also do a morning talk show, Good Mythical Morning. $5 million. German Garmendi. I don't know who any of these people are. I just want to say.
Same.
I feel so old. I feel so old.
I saw this list. Yeah.
This is Latin America's biggest YouTube hit, the Chilean comedy and music star, 48 million subs. Marky Plyer? Is that how you say his name?
Sure.
$5.5 million. No idea. It makes you feel like you're just culturally illiterate. Tyler Oakley, $6 million.
Yeah, rolling my eyes so hard.
Rosanna Pansino, $6 million. She says, I think we're in one of the most exciting times ever for on-demand entertainment.
I'm sure she does.
Sure you do. At $6 million, I would too. Smosh?
They're still around. What?
They started their channel in 2005. $7 million because they run all these other channels.
Yeah.
Basically. That's the way to make money. Become a mogul.
Exactly.
Like me. I'm right. a mogul. Wait a minute. Now I'm getting Lily Singh, $7.5 million. She's a Canadian rapper, comedian, and dancer.
She gets all kinds of endorsements. She's great.
I think that's really where a lot of this is from, is endorsements, right?
Totally.
Secret ads and stuff. Roman Atwood, $8 million. There he is. Number one, PewDiePie, $15 million.
All right.
I'm just jealous. You know me.
I've never seen a PewDiePie video. I've never seen a video from any of the people on that list. I live in a parallel universe.
Well, and you know, this is why I wonder why there's so much money in it, because it's younger people. It's like,
yeah, it's
like under 20 year olds, right? It's not.
If you've ever been to VidCon, like VidCon literally
it's incredible.
And this is, these people are gods. I mean, the kids go wild.
That's with
wild.
A lowercase g, I hope. Like a Thor Loki level.
I don't know. I mean, seeing the way some of these YouTubers at VidCon, you know, like seeing the reaction and the fans, it's...
I know.
Otherworldly. I mean, it really is. I mean, they are the real celebrities. I mean, and then it goes into the other things. They're like full on fandoms for some of these YouTubers, like full on. And that's incredible. So I think that there's a certain disconnect for, you know, like those of us on this panel where we don't spend all of our time watching all of our content on YouTube. You know, we still, you know, use like traditional, you know, media stuff. And for me anyway, my idea of a celebrity is different than what somebody who's 15 years old is. You know,
somebody
it just
in
is.
The chat room said, interesting take on this. We should honor these people because they're creating opportunity for young people.
Are they though?
For 10 young people.
Well, the thing is,
they're
more
creating opportunities for young people than Shaquille O'Neal is creating opportunities for young people.
Right.
You get very lucky. Well, part of it is luck. Part of it is hard work. Part of it is talent. But it's
they
all
work their butt.
They
work their butts off. Everybody I know who's a success works really hard.
Absolutely. But the idea that anybody could do this is a lie because no, very talented people who have a certain je ne sais quoi and and you know.
The only one I really know is iJustine, who's not on that list, but makes probably makes $1 million a year, and she works her butt off. Mm-hmm. And has a lot of following on YouTube and is in the YouTube Rewind. I was wrong. I thought she wasn't, but it's because she's wearing a Sia wig, so you can't see her. But she works really hard, and a lot of her money comes from endorsements outside work. That's YouTube is, at I think in most cases, at best a launching point for a more traditional career.
Right. If anything, like, they're all a sign that, oh, yeah, a kid could do something like this, and YouTube is the platform. They don't need to wait for permission to get
That's
on,
what like, I like TV about it. There's no gatekeeper.
That's very true.
You don't have to get past Rupert Murdoch or Roger Ailes.
Right.
And God knows, getting past Roger Ailes is, he's very grabby.
But it's funny, because I've talked to some of these YouTubers for years, and the irony, I mean, it's changed a little bit, but, like, you always ask them, well, what's your next big goal? And so many of them, if you really like, as much as they talk about how much they love and they, oh, I just need to do the YouTube thing. As soon as you give them the opportunity to be on a more established platform, they jump, they will go. And you know what I mean? Like Miranda Sings is a perfect example, you know, like she got the opportunity to do a Netflix show and who would say no to that? Right. But it just, to me, there's a certain amount of, I have to kind of laugh because I'm like, oh, you keep talking about how this is the future and regular media is dead. But any of them, if they had the opportunity to do more established media, to be on regular, on either broadcast or cable or do a movie or, you know, be on Netflix or whatever, they would take it.
Here's Fred Shigglesworth.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to him?
I mean, that's sort of the problem, right?
Well, I think the shelf life of a YouTube star is relatively short, although PewDiePie's been around for a few years now. Yeah.
And I've just seen, you know, she's been around for a long time because, like you said, she's worked really hard. But yeah, I think that you age out at a certain point. You've got to continue to be, because that audience,
it's young. It's a young audience, so you can't be somebody like somebody my age is never going to be a YouTube star.
No, and I think that even people like, you know, if you were try to start it now, it would be difficult because you need to appeal to just a different demographic.
Yeah,
To babies, just appeal to toddlers. And that's the next YouTube star.
That's the next big thing. I think Amazing Orange appeals to pretty young people.
There you go. But Ed, my suggestion to you, watch the South Park episode with PewDiePie. I think that'll both introduce you to PewDiePie and also tell you why we're all just old.
I got to watch it.
In general.
Oh, I got to watch it.
It's a great episode.
Oh, I didn't know he's a deal.
Thanks.
Now
thanks
he's a celebrity. I didn't know he's on
it's
South Park.
It's all about, because it's the South Park kids reacting to their younger siblings who are into watching the video games. And the South Park kids are like, but we like playing the video games. And then their parents are like, why do you guys play video games? You're just wasting your time. Go outside. Like, it's every generational shift of people thinking, you know, the other
generation. It's really true, isn't
time.
It?
Yeah. That's pretty much it.
Get some fresh air.
Like video games.
Your eyes will stick that way.
Yeah. I think, I like actually doing things. I don't know about
my parents had a very strict rule about how much I could watch TV. Mm-hmm. At one point, it was down to half an hour a night.
Yeah, mine did too. And then it didn't work.
It didn't work.
Look what happened.
As soon as I got old enough, I bought a TV and I watched it nonstop. We're going to have more in just a moment with our great panel, but first, we had a great week this week on Twit, and we have made a fantastic trailer that you're going to get to watch in the comfort and convenience of your home right now.
Previously on Twit.
I was in France last week, and it's nougat. It's not.
I know, I know.
Listen, I was there for 12 hours. I am clearly an expert in French now.
iOS Today.
So today we're going to talk about snip, 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 cutting the cord. Over the top.
Over the top. So we'll show you DirecTV Now, PlayStation View, and Sling TV. You should pick the one that has the channels you want because there's a lot of overlap, but there's also a lot of exclusives.
Tech News Today
Amazon officially teased their rumored brick-and-mortar grocery store today with their patented new Just Walk Out technology. You scan your phone on the way into the store, and then you choose what you want off the shelves, and then you walk out. You just walk out, like shoplifting. It's awesome. What? It's called Amazon Go.
All about Android.
It was around this time last year that there was all those wild rumors running around that you guys were going to merge Android and Chrome OS.
For us, there's no point in merging them. They're both successful. We just want to make sure that both sides benefit from each other. So that's why we brought the apps, Google Play from Android over to Chrome OS. And then, for instance, the update mechanism from Chrome OS to Nougat.
If you missed Twit this week, you missed a lot.
That was a great week behind, but what's in the week ahead? Jason Howell has the deets.
Thanks, Leo. Here's a look at just a few of the stories that we'll be watching in the week ahead. It's a little quiet because we're getting close to the holidays, but here's what we got. On Monday, December 12th, Microsoft will begin to allow Oculus Rift owners to stream their Xbox One games into the VR headset by way of the Xbox One Streaming to Oculus Rift app. Nice app name there, Microsoft. Also, if you're one of those eagerly awaiting a big update to Pokemon Go, prepare for an infusion of new Pokemon on the 12th. Fans have been hoping for the inclusion of Generation 2 Pokemon. We'll see what they get. I say they because I stopped playing months ago. But in games I might actually play a heck of a lot of news, Nintendo is set to release Super Mario Run to the iOS App Store on Thursday, December 15th for $9.99. Expensive for a mobile game, but those who've played it mostly say it proudly carries the Nintendo level of quality throughout. That was a lot of gaming news. Anyways, there's other technology news. Megan Maroney and I will be covering all of this and a whole lot more all week on Tech News Today, each and every weekday at 4 p.m. Pacific. That's a look at the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
Thank you, Jason. Don't forget Tech News Today, your daily dose of tech news, Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 2400 UTC on Twit.tv. Our show today brought you by Wealthfront. Look, if you're PewDiePie and you're making $15 million a year, you got to sock some of that away for your old age, like when you turn 30. Then what are you going to do? Wealthfront is about saving long-term investments, not saving a savings account or buying a CD, but really investing your money so there'll be something for retirement, for college, you know, for buying that first house. You could, of course, put it in get a stock broker and, you know, get a retired wealth advisor and have that person. Now, first of all, I always ask the question, well, if you're sitting in this in the strip mall with a little sign out front saying wealth advisor and you're telling me how to invest, why are you still here if you're so smart? What are you doing here? And by the way, those guys charge you 1, 2, or even 3% of what you have under investment every year. That means you have to make 3% more to break even. Not going to happen. Wealthfront is a part of a kind of a revolution. They call them sometimes robot investors. It's a computer doing the work, but a computer that's been trained by some of the smartest minds in the business. People like Burton Malkiel, who wrote The Random Walk Down Wall Street, and Charles D. Ellis, The Investor's Guide. These guys, the people on the board at Wealthfront, have the most incredible backgrounds. And so you're getting the benefit of their knowledge, and it's built into something that checks your portfolio not every week or month or year or even every hour, every minute, constantly in reinvesting, doing things, very sophisticated things like tax loss harvesting that maximize your returns, minimize your tax bill, and you're going to see the benefit. And all of this comes not for 1, 2, or 3% of what they manage, but for 0.25% a year. And there are never any commissions or hidden fees. They're not investing on their account. They're helping because it's a computer. It's helping you. Wealthfront's portfolios are based on modern portfolio theory designed to adjust according to your risk tolerance while staying diversified and tax efficient. This is the stuff you need. You can, by the way, they have 529 college savings plans, like a Roth IRA for college. They have 401k rollovers. You can roll over your 401k. They have Roth IRAs. They have traditional IRAs, trust accounts, joint accounts, individual accounts, long-term investment. This is not day trading. This is for money you're going to put aside for that rainy day. $3 billion now almost in client assets, and they grow all the time. They're really good. This is the way to do it. And I'm not even telling you to invest. I'm saying just go to wealthfront.com/twit. They will. You can go through the question and answer process, you know, the few questions that they ask, get a free investment portfolio designed based on those questions for you, what they would start you with. You'll see the customized allocation they recommend for your time frame, your risk tolerance, all of that. And you can get started if you decide that looks pretty good. You can put as little as $500 in. That's how you start. That's all. But I have to tell you, your first $15,000 is free of charge. Not a quarter of 1%, but free forever. But you got to go to wealthfront.com/twit. This is a really great solution. This is the hottest. I read an article in the Wall Street Journal that says people like Schwab, they're terrified by this company. It changes the whole equation, puts the power in your hands. Wealthfront.com/twit. Talking about putting the power in your hands, Amazon's got a new grocery store where there's no clerks. Man, how many people are going to lose their jobs for this? You go in, you walk in the store, you scan a barcode on your phone, pick up what you want, and walk out. That's it. They've got the kind of, you know, the sensors they have in Vegas in the mini bars, but they also have cameras. So somebody can't just like pick up a bottle of cherries and put them in your bag. You get charged. This is wild. Now there's one already in operation in Seattle. Near Amazon's headquarters, but I think more to come. What do you think?
Say, I love the idea in theory. I don't know how well it would work in practice. I would never want to do like full grocery shopping this way because I frankly like someone bagging my groceries for me.
Point. You can't bag, huh? Yeah. You got to bag yourself.
Yeah. You got to bag yourself. But I think that's like a bodega, like a stop and grab. Honestly, this would be great because there are plenty of times when I go into a Duane Reade or a CVS or something, right, and I just want a Diet Coke. I don't want to have, and then you have to wait in this long line.
I love it. You walk in and you walk out.
Yeah, that would be great. To your point, obviously, I don't love the implications of what this means for the service industry. You know, I don't like mm-hmm. to think that people will be out of jobs, but I personally, selfishly, would really like to just be able to like walk into a bodega and walk out without
and
having
to. And this isn't a self-scan.
Wait in line.
I never use a self-scan thing because yeah. I feel like that never works well.
Those things have gotten better, but the self scans have definitely been, yeah, the next step towards a situation right. where, yeah, you could just go in and walk out. I mean, losing cashier jobs is one thing. I think that's one of the most, I forget who had the stat, but it's like one of the most prolific jobs in America right now.
That's where everybody starts out, right?
Yeah.
Bagging, yeah. checking. You
so
still
losing
have to have stock boys,
problem.
Although it's only a matter of time before they have little robots going around filling the shelves.
Exactly. Exactly. Like what's happening in Amazon's warehouses right now.
Right.
But the bigger problem is I think we're kind of optimizing human interaction out of our future. And what does that mean?
That's more of that filter bubble thing. I'm telling you, I don't want to talk to humans. I just want to watch my visor, floating chair, big gulp. Mm-hmm. I'm happy.
Yeah. Like sometimes, yeah, I do want to go into Duane Reade and just get like some candy or something or whatever I need. But, you know, my local bodega guy, I go in there, I say hello.
Yeah.
We have like a working relationship.
That's the bodega is part of the community.
Yeah.
This is a huge thing in New Mexico as well. People who mm-hmm. come and visit here, my wife and I talk about this all the time, but people who come and visit here, you can tell that when the tourists are in town because they show up at the grocery store and the person who's in front of them in line is talking to the checker, how you doing? How's Maria? Mm-hmm. How's Joseph doing? And they have this conversation and they're going, can you speed it up? And it's like, no, the whole point of this is these are people who live in a community yes. and they know each other.
Yes.
And there is a human interaction going on here. One of the things about Amazon Go that bothers me is two things. Number one is it's just more stuff to track us. Everything is.
Oh, don't you think they already do that though? Come on.
See, I was gonna say I'm not bothered by the tracking because if you have a loyalty card, they already
know
everything.
I bet Ed didn't, and I've never bought a loyalty card, even though.
Yeah, but they probably don't have.
Actually, none of the stores that we go to use loyalty cards anymore.
Yeah.
They don't even have them. So you don't.
The thing I hate about loyalty. So if you go to a Lucky or a Safeway here, they charge you like 20% more because you don't have a loyalty card. I don't see it as like the loyalty card's giving you a discount. I see you getting penalized.
The right price.
They are basically paying you to allow yourself to be tracked. You know, so that's one thing that bothers me. But the other thing that it goes back to the conversation we were having an hour ago, which is every form of technology like this eventually winds up being abused by people who don't have scruples or morals. And I wonder if they've thought through the implications of this.
Well, that's why they're doing it in Seattle first, because everybody's nice in Seattle.
Well, yeah, but Amazon is good at this kind of thing, you know, and they'll do a few of these things. But if it heads out, you know, you get the companies that aren't so good at it.
Yeah.
And I don't know where it goes, but there's just opportunities for this to go bad.
3 million jobs, according to Roland 00 in our chat room, are 3 million checkers. In the U.S. That's a lot of jobs. You add that to the people who drive, which is 1.4% of the job market. They're going to be losing their job. I mean, and all this does is create just absolute disruption. And yet, I think it's inevitable. I think technology doesn't stop because it's going to cost jobs, does it?
No,
automation is automation is it isn't moving jobs offshore that's caused the loss of jobs in this country. 90% of the jobs that are lost have been lost to automation. In some cases, the automation is offshore. In most cases, it's right here. But you know, that was the case in the 19th century and the 20th century, and it will be in the 21st century as well. Automation takes people's jobs, and we should be thinking about what the next step is for the people whose jobs go away, because if they don't have education and skills to step into something that replaces it, then we're creating economic chaos.
Well, and the jobs we're talking about, being a truck driver, for instance, is one of the highest paid things you can do without a college degree. Cashier is a classic entry level occupation. But those go first. By the way, this is the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Lovely picture of a cashier checking out the flowers, and it's just a communal experience. Aww. Never gonna not gonna be like that anymore. You just kind of go in, take what you want. But those are the jobs that go first. But I don't think it's the end of the line by any means. I think more and more of the jobs. Look, you guys, you're writers. Your livelihood is threatened. We're already seeing automated sports writing.
Yeah, sure. Although I think for some of the, I like that some of the worst stories, like earnings reports. That's kind of the first one.
Let the computer do the earnings reports.
I don't want to write that.
Let me
extrapolate from that information. You could repeat the press release or whatever. Yeah. So that sort of thing is fine. I do think we need to have a more ethical consideration of like where these jobs are going, you know, because a lot of people in the country are worried about jobs going offshore or immigrants coming in and taking your jobs. And it turns out it's really progress. It's really automation that's going to be doing that, like Ed has been saying. So what do we do about that? We have to be aware of it, and we kind of have to, I don't know, either as a society, we need to do something better. Some people have talked about this being like a good reason to have. Maybe we should think harder about the minimum, you know, what do you call it? The minimum income or something, like the secured income for everybody,
guaranteed
which may never
income.
Happen. Guaranteed income. Yeah. Will probably never happen. But I think that sounds like a good idea, especially if all this stuff is getting automated.
There is some controversy over guaranteed minimum income as well, though, because what tends to happen is you give people a cash payment, but you eliminate every one of their, health care, food stamps, Head Start. You eliminate all the other programs because that's how you fund it. And nothing could possibly go wrong. It gives somebody $1,000 a week and
hopefully,
say, spend it any way you want.
Yeah. Hopefully an automation-rich society could afford to do that. You know, if we're saving so much money by automating our workflows.
Except that's not what would happen, because instead the companies, the automation rich companies, are the ones who make money, and those executives and the people at top,
we're already seeing the consequences of income inequality, and it's only going to get worse. And I think as long as we're talking about interesting futures, that's another one we're going to have to think
automation
about.
Automation tax, guys. Automation.
Yeah. Tax the automators.
Yeah.
Steve Kovac's going to be on the show next week, I think, but he wrote this week in Business Insider, wearables are dead.
Poor Pebble.
Pebble's dead. They've been basically, it's sad because Pebble, at one point, somebody was offering $740 million, right?
That's the rumor. I don't know how if that deal was real. That's accurate. I don't know how.
They turned it down.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how a board would let you turn that down. Even if you think, even if like you wanted to stay independent, I don't understand how your board of investors would be willing to say, yeah, we're going to turn this down. So there's something fishy about that to me. There's something about that that just doesn't seem right, because if you genuinely had an offer like that on the table, I don't see how you ever in any circumstance would be like, yeah, we're going to keep going.
Especially for a company like Pebble, which has not exactly been on fire. Ever.
No,
you know, they've had hype, but if you
think about it, though, remember, the story was, it was from Citizen, the Japanese, almost 100-year-old Japanese watchmaker. If you're, last year, you're wondering where your future is as a watchmaker. You might say, well, we got to get in on this wearable thing.
I would agree that Citizen might look into it. What I'm saying is, I don't understand how anybody at Pebble on their board or any investors would ever turn it down. Which is what the reporting, some of the reporting says, is that Pebble was the one who said no. And that's the part that to me just doesn't jive with reality.
Then Intel made an offer for $70 million.
That seems more realistic. And I actually could understand turning that down, even though it was double what Fitbit reportedly paid for the assets, just because $70 million might not have been enough to cover debts and might not have been a big enough return for the investors. So I think they'd raised about $35 million. It might not have been enough of a return. And you're thinking, well, if we can have one more hit, if we can make this work financially, if this next product can bring us back into the market, then we shouldn't sell for $70 million. I could see turning that down. That one, I'm with you, Devinder. Like, that seems realistic. Mm-hmm. $740 million. That just,
well, they're not getting anywhere near any of that. Fitbit's buying Pebble. We don't know for how much, according to the information, around
$40 million.
Around $40 million.
Yeah,
and that barely covers their debt.
Yeah, I don't even think it did. I mean, I think that they bought the assets, they bought the software assets, and some of the employees, and I guess the patents.
So is Steve Kovac? I mean, that's one bit of evidence. The other bit is that Motorola has said, we're not going to make another Android Wear watch. Google's delayed Android Wear 3.0 till next year.
Apple Watch sale.
Nobody's making money except maybe Apple and Fitbit.
I'm sure that Apple, yeah, exactly. Well, and Fitbit stock has been in the tank this year for a lot of reasons. They haven't, sold as many units as they projected to sell. So it's not even just, smartwatches. It's fitness trackers too. And then there's, the Apple Watch, obviously there's an IDC report that came out a couple months ago. And then the identical report came out last week, that says that Apple Watch sales were down significantly.
Yeah, but then Tim Cook comes out and says, oh no, it's the best sales we've ever had. We broke all records. He didn't give any numbers.
You know what? And when they don't have any numbers, that's when you know that there isn't a really good story to tell. I looked at that quote too. It's a very interesting, very lawyerly quote.
Yeah.
It was about sales during the holiday week.
Right. Yeah.
Sales during the holiday week, blah, blah, blah. And you know what? So then I went back to my news feed where I said, where I had Black Friday deals coming in on a news feed.
Okay, yep.
And guess what? Best Buy and Target, among others, had huge discounts on existing Apple Watch stock. So I think this was, I think they, and probably those were subsidized by Apple, moved this stuff out of the way to make room for the current generation product. But it sounds like they had warehouses full of this stuff, and they were able to give incentives on this stuff of $100, $150 off of the regular sales price for these things. And you're going to shift a lot of merchandise at that point.
Yeah.
You're not going to get traditional Apple margins at all.
This is Tim Cook's quote for Reuters. Sales growth is off the charts. That is, by the way, a meaningless statement. In fact, during the first week of holiday shopping, our sell-through, this important sell-through of Apple Watch, was greater than any week in the product's history. Any week. And as expected, we're on track for the best quarter ever for Apple Watch. But you're right, it could just be because they drastically cut Series 1's prices.
Yeah, they cut Series 1 prices, and there were some deals on Series 2's. And you also have to think that the average selling price on Apple Watch with Series 2 has gone down because, they're not selling. They're really hyping up the sport model, you know, they don't even call it the sport anymore, versus, you know, the ceramic, which they're selling for, you know, a lot more money. So, like, they, you know, they're not even really emphasizing the stainless steel anymore. So, I think that, who knows what the sales are. They're probably making more money than anybody else in the smartwatch space. But mm-hmm. I think that anybody who's trying to make the argument, like, the Apple Watch has been this huge bona fide hit. I mean, I'm somebody who's been wearing an Apple Watch every day for 18 months, and that's just not true. You know, I get use out of it, I guess, but I like mine.
Yeah.
But it's not, it didn't change my life. And certainly this is the one time of year. It was this way last year too, but this is the one time of year where my friends are like, should I buy an Apple Watch? Which one should I get? And I think it's because it's a decent holiday item to buy. It's mm-hmm. Fitness trackers are the same way. You know, people start to get excited about the new year. You start to
$90 rethink. Fitbit's an easier buy though, right?
Well, I think a $270 Apple Watch, you know, it is and it's not. I mean, if you're also buying it, you know, kind of with a fashion thing involved. I mean, I think that there are plenty of people who say I might be able to, you know, if I have $150 yeah. for this or what, I can see people making the leap from a fashion.
And that's a faster device than the original Apple Watch Sport, right?
Yes, so
that's that's a good
it's
deal.
It's better in every
respect. This is a very coastal elite point of view,
yes,
I have to
yes.
say.
Of course, yes. $270
is a lot of money. That's for most people that, you know, they're going to spend that on a phone, maybe, every 5 years.
Right.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
But I think,
especially when you get a Timex for $20.
Mm-hmm. And there is the problem. The Apple Watch and the Android Wear things too. I bought an Android Wear watch 6 months ago just to, and I think it was on some sort of, you know, Amazon deal of the day kind of thing. So I said, I'll check this out, and, you know, tried it for 2 weeks and said, you know, this,
it's just not compelling. It wasn't
compelling. I sent it back and, you know, and got my money back. And I said, and it was one of the better ones that I, you know, that I had bought. But so I think that's the problem with the category, is that it is always going to be an add-on for, you know, for a phone. And so you've already got a small percentage of the market out there. And then, you know, so whatever percentage of the phone market you've got, now you can get some small percentage of that as an add-on for it. That's a good that's a fine business model for Apple, because Apple can do that the same way they can do with the AirPods. They can make money on add-on products. Nobody else has the volume to make money with add-on products. Nobody.
Yeah, and outside of smartwatches, I think where, like, the traditional activity trackers, the prices have just kind of bottomed out, right? You could get some really, really cheap ones from no-name manufacturers, even some, like, well-known manufacturers for $30 to $50, you know, so
the software differentiation isn't big enough to for a lot of people to make the leap. You know, they have an app and it tracks their steps, and that's what they want it for.
Yeah.
You know what I'm getting my son for Christmas? I'm getting him in a Harry's Shave kit. Let's take a break. Well, I got the weirdest story of the week coming up in a second. Harry's, for guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of the price. This is the time of year where you go to Harry's and you can find some great gifts. It was started by two best friends, Jeff and Andy. They said, why are we being charged so much for razor blades at the drugstore? They lock them up so you won't steal them. Why is that? So they started Harry's, and they did the right thing. They got investors, and they took all the money the investors gave them, and they bought the razor blade factory in Germany, one of two factories that makes the best razor blades in the world. They bought it. So now you're buying factory direct. Your razor blades cost half as much as drugstore blades. And they're great. And the Harry's kits are even better. All the kits come with a razor handle, and you get to choose, you know, depending on which kit you get. Shaving, you can even get it engraved if you want. Shaving cream, you get three blades, you know, and there's three cartridges. These are all five-blade cartridges with the flex hinge, the precision trimmer for the sideburns, which I really like. The Winston set includes an engravable chrome handle, like I said. You can choose from the foam, which is kind of the traditional. I actually like the cream. And then you sign up for replenishment. And every month you get the blade you need, the cream you need. You never have to use a blade longer than you should. You always have a nice, great, clean shave. What a great holiday gift. Go to harrys.com. You could save $5 right now for the guy on your Christmas list with the offer code TWIT5, TWIT in the number 5. But if you want to get it for the holidays, ground shipping ends December 16th. So you only have a few more days. Go right now to harrys.com. And don't forget that offer code TWIT5 for $5 off. I hope Henry's not watching. See, I didn't get his engraved, but I figured the H on there, he'd think it was Henry, right? Using the old noggin there. Hey, if you know somebody with an H in his name, buy it. You got to. Harrys.com, the number, the offer code, rather, TWIT, and the number 5. The weird story of the week. Outside the Trump Tower, 30 demonstrators gather to make John McAfee the nation's cybersecurity czar.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
What?
No. Let's not do that.
No. I think it was organized by Anonymous, and probably they did it for the lulls. I hope so.
Maybe, because he was the first person to tweet about it, and then that tweet mysteriously disappeared. Maybe he was the one who organized it.
Oh, interesting. He gave them all masks. If you're a hacking group, who better to be in charge of cybersecurity than a guy who's stoned out of his mind?
Than a guy who's completely nuts.
Right? McAfee will make the internet safe.
Sure.
That's what the poster said. Cybersecurity czar.
It's great software when he actually was making software. McAfee was always great, guys. It was never terrible.
Never terrible.
Always.
Now, let's be fair, though. You probably can't blame John McAfee for the McAfee software.
He wrote the first version,
but I doubt he was.
Sure.
You can blame him for all the other things he's been tied to. So. How about that?
He was working on the 90s. It was bad in the 90s. I don't know.
He was at CES last year. He was like hawking this little startup. I gotta look up the name. But I got him on camera, guys. And that was one of the most amazing interviews I ever had. You could tell like the rage in his face as I was talking to him, because I was kind of like, that was when he was announcing his presidential campaign. Yeah. And I was just like really pushing against all of his talking points. So that was a fun interview. You can check that out on Engadget.
Yeah. Wow. Go look for that one. Hey, Leo.
Yeah.
You're a pumpkin. I know. I can see it happening right now. Your face is starting to swell. So
thank you,
EdBot, ZDNet.com. Ed does the greatest coverage of Windows. I didn't have any Windows stories for you, but I got to tell you, I love, and I don't think this is a surprise to anybody who watches our shows, this Surface Studio is awesome. Did you notice that's what I'm using?
I did, and I've been doing this here on a Surface Book, so, you know, we're
who knew?
The direct channel.
Who
direct
knew? Channel. I can't
all
believe
Surface
it.
All the time.
I mean, I've been a Mac guy since 1984. Unbelievable. We're actually hacking
great
this.
Great meeting you, Christina.
Great meeting
Thanks
you,
so
Ed.
Much.
See you, Ed.
See you.
Great seeing you, Ed.
See you later, guys.
We're hacking the Father Robert tomorrow, and KnowHow is going to put a SSD in this. And
nice.
That should be fun.
Help it speed up. This, we'll wrap up with this. This is the best Minecraft mod I've ever seen. Somebody has created an Atari 2600 emulator.
Oh, that's so cool.
In Minecraft.
Oh, my God.
He's playing Donkey Kong. Look how big it, by the way, in order to do these things, you got to make it huge.
Right.
You got to make it huge to do this. I mean, look, it literally is the circuitry and everything. Look how big that is. Fortunately, in Minecraft, in creative mode, you can fly, so that's not a problem. And this is a YouTube video if you want to check it out. An Atari 2600 emulator. Unbelievable. Let's skip ahead and watch. It's probably not quite the fastest emulator you've ever seen. Those barrels aren't exactly flying down. But it's playing Donkey Kong. Devendra Hardawar and Engadget, so great to have you, Devendra. We missed you last week, but I'm glad you could make it this week. I really appreciate
always
it.
Always glad to be here, Leo.
Yeah. Always a pleasure. Film girl, you're the greatest. I meant to ask you about the Snapchat spectacles. You waited 5 hours in line and you hate yourself for it.
I do hate myself for it, but yeah, they're fun. They're fun.
Are you still using them?
I am. They're fun.
Can I follow you on Snapchat and see?
You can. I'm film_girl on Snapchat.
And you're like, what happens? You can share, you press a button in 10 seconds of video.
Yeah, and then you know, you open up your phone and it syncs the video, and you can choose which ones you want to share. So
it doesn't just kind of go out automatically.
It doesn't go automatically. No, you pick and choose which videos you want to share, because you could share them to your story or you could send them to individuals. So
wow, never found that. I know the show must be over because my Pixel has just gone into night mode. What the hell? I'm even going to get out of here. That's never happened before. Thank you, Film Girl. Thank you, Devendra. Thank you all for being here. We do This Week in Tech every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, until night falls. That would be 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC. We'd love it if you stop by. Join us in the chat room. If you can't, though, don't worry. On-demand audio and video is always available after the fact at twit.tv and wherever you get your podcasts. We're working on our best of. So we have one more week, believe it or not. Next week, great show planned for you. And then 2 weeks from now is Christmas Day. Oof. Have you finished your shopping? Get going.
No, got to get started.
Can I get you to wait in line for a couple more Snapchat spectacles for me?
Well, now the line is easier. Now they give you a time to come back, and they have 3 Snapbots. So the day after I waited for 5 hours, they changed the whole line setup.
Because, man, I would be a hero if I got that for my kids. Oh, man, would I be a hero. I finally saw him yesterday. We did on the new screensavers. Trey Ratcliffe's daughter, Scarlett, who's about 8, has a pair.
Awesome.
They're so cute. Do you have them with you right now? Could you put them on?
Yeah, hold on 1 second.
So we're putting together our best of episode for Christmas Day. And then actually Christmas Day, we have the holiday episode, which is a great roundtable with Denise Howell. Steve Gibson flew up and Denise flew up from L.A., and Renee Ritchie flew down from Montreal, and it was really a lot of fun talking about the most important stories of 2016. So that's the 25th. And the following week is New Year's Eve, and that's going to be our best of. So if you remember something that happened great, actually it's New Year's Day, remember something that great that happened on Twit in 2016, twit.tv/best of or any of the shows. And yeah, I know it has these red stars they require. Actually, they took them off, didn't they? Thank you. There is all these fields. You don't have to know the time code, okay? You don't have to know exactly when it aired. Whatever information you know would be great. That'd be very helpful. And if you are doing some holiday shopping, you have a couple more days to get the Twit Army shirts. Oh, look at you.
Yep.
You got the black ones.
I have them in the coral too, but the black ones look better.
So you could get a total of 2.
Yeah, you can buy 2 at once. And so
I went to eBay. I can get them for $300 on eBay. Is it worth it?
I mean, I think they're pretty fun. Yeah.
For wouldn't you, be for Leo, me. I don't snap.
It'd be for your kids. For your kids. Yeah.
It's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, but they're fun. And they're actually really well made.
They seem like it. They're actually kind of cool. So one is the camera and the other one's a light.
Exactly. So the camera is on the right-hand side and the light is on the left-hand side. And, you know, the build quality, they feel kind of like Ray-Bans. I mean, they're a lot better.
They're not that
expensive.
What, they're $129?
$130 if you're able to wait in the line. I mean, what I would say, if you could find a line waiter in New York, Leo, somebody to...
I hear that's not hard, and it's going to get easier when all those people don't have checkout jobs.
Right, but if you might be able to like look at like, you know, somebody to wait in line for you, pay somebody, you know, to wait in line and then send them to you, it might be cheaper than $300 a pair.
Oh, I could do that, and I could trust them to mail them to me?
I mean, you could look for reviews on TaskRabbit and stuff like that and see. But
get a TaskRabbit to do it.
Yeah.
There you go. Boy, I'd be a celebrity in my house. Do you have a pair, Devendra?
No, I'm
you're working
like
in Gadget. You have every excuse to get a pair.
No, that's other people in Gadget.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't supposed to be the person at Gizmodo, but, you know, I was the one who was willing to wait in line for 5 hours. So wow. It happened.
Hey, anybody could do it if they wait in line. Now that it's easier, I expect to see more on eBay for an even a more affordable price.
Oh, without a doubt. My friend Jim went and got them for his daughter yesterday, and he showed up in line because now, you know, they basically will say, he showed up in line around 5 o'clock and they said, well, come back at 7:30 and you can, or 4 o'clock and said, come back at 7:30 and you can, you know, pick them up. And he was like, well, I could go home. So he just came back earlier the next day and, you know, was able to get a stamp and a ticket. And then, you know, they tell you now what time to come back. And in the process, you know, probably 30 minutes to an hour after that. So fortunately, most people won't have to do what I did. I wish that obviously that had been the case when I, you know, waited in the cold for 5 hours, but hey.
But you have them.
But I have them. I have them. So, yeah.
Well, if you look, I can get you something less expensive. Go to teespring.com/twit. No waiting. You'll get your Twit Army. We got nice ones. These are nice. This is the t-shirt. We also have hoodies now. Isn't that cool? Anthony Nielsen did that design. I love that. Love it. Well, we'll send you one. But you only have a few more days if you want to get it in time for Christmas. And we're going to pull that off once that date passes because we don't want anybody to be disappointed. But that's 3 days from now. But, yeah, but we're going to put them, but they'll be back because we're going to do like a regular Twit store. I've been looking at Snapchat and thinking, I need a vending machine with balloons on it. And I could make a killing.
Open it up across from the Apple Store on Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you so much to all of our guests, to Ed Bott, who's gone, but also to Christina and Devendra. You guys are great. Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye. Yay. Doing the Twit.